Biddy Mason Memorial Park on Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles is hidden. It's hidden behind a parking lot, an obscure place dedicated to a local icon that most Angelenos don't even know.
We don't know a lot about African-American history, and we don't know a lot about women's history.
Brenda Stevenson is a professor of history and African-American studies at UCLA.
We still have a narrative that's focused on white men. So there are gaps in our history, and Biddy Mason falls into some of those gaps.
So who was Biddy Mason? And why is there a park named after her? Well, she was an enslaved single mother of three, midwife, businesswoman, church founder, a city matriarch. Biddy Mason left an indelible mark on Los Angeles.
This is a person who was born a slave and is able to create something wonderful and lasting in one of the greatest cities in the world. And so her story needs to take a public space and public consciousness.
Today on Greater LA, part of our ongoing series on LA street names, we take up the story of one Los Angeles street that doesn't exist. Reporter Mike Schlitt asks, why not?
This is Cheryl Cox,
the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Biddy Mason.
And this is Robin Cox,
the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Biddy Mason. Yes, we're sisters.
We are at Biddy Mason's Park.
This is where her homestead was established after she moved to California.
On a wall in the park is a photograph of Biddy Mason.
It's the only known portrait of Biddy Mason.
It is an amazing photograph. I just can't stop looking at it.
She says everything with her eyes and her presence and her demeanor. You realize what type of woman she was, how strong she was, how powerful she was, and how she didn't take no for an answer.
Down in Mississippi, way down.
Biddy Mason was born in 1818, probably in Georgia. She was given as a wedding gift to Robert and Rebecca Smith, plantation owners in Mississippi. Biddy added to their family wealth by giving birth to three daughters, Ellen, Anne, and Harriet.
She was coming out of this institution that was meant to break you. She did what she needed to do to keep her family together.
She made herself invaluable, learning herbal medicines, skills as a midwife and a nurse.
She was a very important figure in the household, taking care of Robert Smith, the slave master's wife, because she was quite ill.
When Robert Smith converted to a new religion, Mormonism, he decided to move his family and all of his property out west. The journey was grueling.
She walked herding cattle, taking care of her own three children. They walked from Mississippi to Utah first, because they were Mormons. After leaving Utah, they eventually ended up in Southern California.
3 years later, in 1851, the Smith family, plus 14 enslaved people, arrived. Los Angeles was a frontier town, just about 1,600 people. Not a lot of them were black. But fortunately, historian Brenda Stevenson says,
Biddy Mason is able to connect herself with intelligent and well-off free African-Americans in California who inform her, guess what? You are in California now.
And California law says you are free.
Robert Smith, her quote-unquote owner at the time, getting wind to the fact that he's going to lose his slave property, has decided to move back to Texas, a slave state.
He hides Biddy Mason and the rest of his human chattel in the Santa Monica Mountains. But the friends of Biddy Mason fight back.
They go to the sheriff in San Bernardino County and say, look, this man is holding these people illegally, and he's about to steal them and take them back to Texas.
Biddy Mason and the others are sent to a Los Angeles jail for their own protection. The slaveholder Smith tries to get them back.
Robert Smith speaks to the sheriff and tells him, no, these people are part of my family. They want to stay with me. She and her children and then the others, they've all agreed to stay with me and to move into Texas. He was telling them at the same time that, you know, once they got to Texas, they would be free, which is just a bold-faced lie.
The judge, Benjamin Hayes, was a religious man.
And he wanted to get to the bottom of what was going on here.
State law didn't allow black people to testify in court, so Judge Hayes decided to question Biddy Mason outside the courtroom. He asked if she consented to the move. Biddy Mason told the judge she did not.
If the judge had ruled in Smith's favor, she could have been put to death. She was going to go out fighting for her freedom.
Then we get to the really miraculous part.
Perfect timing. 1 year later, in the infamous case of Dred Scott v. Sanford, the Supreme Court would rule that enslaved people, no matter what state they lived in, were property, not American citizens.
They have no rights the white man is bound to respect.
After Dred Scott, things would be different. But on this day, in this case, Biddy Mason sued for her freedom and won.
All of the said persons of color are entitled to their freedom and are free forever.
With her family's future secure, Biddy Mason went to work as a free woman in Los Angeles.
She was hired to work as a midwife and nurse.
She was able to serve both the white and the black community.
There were very few doctors in early Los Angeles, so that need allowed her to overcome that color line. Let's face it, when you're sick, you're going to seek help from who has the skills.
After 10 years, she'd saved up enough money to buy some land and build a family homestead.
Here on Spring Street, where we are today.
She did not read and write, so that's why they have an X that's on the wall. And that's how she signed her deeds.
She saved more money and bought more land.
Biddy owned everything between Spring and Broadway, between 3rd and 4th Street.
This was years before Los Angeles became a city.
She was the first black woman property owner in Los Angeles.
And as Los Angeles grew up around her homestead, Biddy Mason became
probably the wealthiest black woman west of the Mississippi.
So what did she do after she made her fortune?
Grandma Biddy had a saying,
if you hold your hand closed, nothing good can come in. For the open hand is blessed, for it gives in abundance even as it receives, which is actually a biblical principle. God will bless those to help others.
She felt the call to service, and she was always willing to step forward and to make herself a part of the solution.
She'd leave a tab open at the local market and allow people to come in and get what they need. She risked her life to treat the prisoners in the prisons when there was an epidemic.
The same prisons she and her family had been forced to live in years earlier.
Everybody in Los Angeles became her family. There weren't schools for black people to go to, so she knew that there needed to be schools. There wasn't a church for black people to worship in, so she knew that she needed to build a church.
In 1872, Biddy Mason led the founding of the first African Methodist Episcopal Church of Los Angeles.
And the church was formed in the living room of her home.
Jackie Broxton has been a member of First AME for 40 years.
The mission of First AME has always been first to serve. And that pretty much encapsulates Biddy Mason's whole take on life.
Good morning, First AME Church of Los Angeles.
Biddy Mason helped build First AME into a cornerstone of the local black community. And it remains so today. She died in 1891 after spending most of her life tending to the needs of the city. So now, how does the city tend to her memory in return?
Just the park. That's it. And the church. If you don't really understand your history, it's impossible to understand what's going on now. It's not right.
LA is full of commemorative spaces dedicated to wealthy power brokers and land barons. Wilshire Boulevard, Crenshaw Boulevard, streets named after William Mulholland, the two Isaacs, Lancashire and Van Nuys. But what about all the other people who built Los Angeles?
Well, I think that Biddy Mason, like most women in the 19th century, were not focused on leaving necessarily a public legacy that would live large in the imaginations of people in the future. It's always been important to reclaim the stories of people who have contributed mightily to our society.
For Cheryl and Robin Cox, reclaiming the story is personal.
It has been ingrained in us that it was our responsibility to be the keepers of our family's legacy.
They're petitioning the city to name a street after Biddy Mason.
This is where her homestead was. We are hoping that with our petition, Los Angeles will rename Spring Street in her honor.
Can changing a name change public memory?
Spring Street would be perfect.
Brenda Stevenson thinks so.
If we are to shift our understanding of American history, that includes all of the people who have helped to build the United States of America, then we need to dedicate more public space to understanding what that history is.
Commemorating a past to construct a better future, that may sound pie in the sky, but if you want inspiration to do something that seems impossible, consider the story of Biddy Mason. Greater LA in Biddy Mason Park. I'm Mike Schlett.
One of the leading Republican candidates in the California recall election, radio host Larry Elder, is facing calls from other Republicans to bow out. That's after Politico interviewed Elder's ex-fiancée and longtime radio producer Alexandra Detig. She said Elder threatened her with a gun during an argument back in 2015. Elder denies it and says he's not leaving the race, which wraps up September 14th. That's the last day for Californians to vote or send in their mail-in ballots. That's just about 3 weeks away. Carla Marinucci broke the story about Larry Elder, and she's here with a recall election update. She covers California politics for Politico. Hi, Carla.
Hey, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, let's talk about this story you broke last week. Talk about what Alexandra Detig said about Larry Elder and what he did with that gun.
Yeah, I mean, these are very disturbing allegations. She was his former fiance. She was his longtime radio producer. She helped him get that Hollywood Walk of Fame star. And she broke off an 18-month engagement with him, she said, in part because of abusive treatment. She talks about this gun incident in which Mr. Elder was in a bedroom with her. They were having a heated argument, and he silently went over to a nightstand, opened it, took out a gun, and very deliberately checked to see if it was loaded while she was talking. And she said he wanted to make sure that I saw that he had it, and she called it a moment that caused the breakup, essentially, of both of them. And at that point, reminded her of kind of a Phil Spector moment is what she called it, referencing that famed Hollywood record producer who shot and killed an actress in his home. This was just one of many incidents, she said, and this is one of many stories now that has kind of piled up on Larry Elder in the last couple of days with regard to his treatment on women. You had CNN reporting on some of his more incendiary comments about women, suggesting that that Donald Trump helped get more obese women off the couch by getting them into the women's marches. You had the San Francisco Chronicle reporting that Mr. Elder said that that women should just maybe take it when they had offensive behavior leveled at them in the workplace, that they should just be silent and take it. There's just a number of stories that have come out, and all of these have prompted both Kevin Faulkner and Caitlyn Jenner in the race to suggest that Larry Elder isn't fit to be governor and that he should withdraw from the race.
Right. He's also said in the past that women know less than men about political issues, economics, and current events. This is a while ago.
There's just a number of stories, a number of headlines that have come out. And, you know, one of the outcomes of our story and some of these headlines has been in just 3 weeks now before the election, Elder's campaign has totally shuffled, and he has just hired on a new campaign manager, Jeffrey Corliss from Orange County, who did work for Carly Fiorina. But that's very unusual to completely change your campaign strategy and your team 3 weeks before an election.
Right. And just to point out that he does deny this accusation from his former girlfriend about the gun.
Yes, he does. I mean, he said he didn't brandish a gun. Depending on how you define brandishing, but the fact is he will not talk to us directly on it, and that's been another issue in the campaign. His relations with the media. He has cut out a major paper, the Sacramento Bee, completely, including photographers, editors, and reporters. And we haven't been able to interview him either, despite numerous attempts.
Right. Well, I saw a clip of him giving a speech where in front of a large audience inside an auditorium, it looked like, where he was saying if he was elected governor, he would repeal mask and vaccine mandates. And I guess it's worth pointing out he's not the only one on the Republican side to do that, to call for that.
No, that's right, Madeline. All of the major Republican candidates have said the same. I think it is interesting. Larry Elder did have a major rally over the weekend in Fresno. He's had a couple of them. He gets big crowds. And yes, the polls suggest he may be sort of at odds with many Californians on issues like the COVID mandates and vaccines, on issues like the minimum wage, which he says he would reduce to nothing. But the fact is, when it comes to the polls, he's leading on the Republican side. And it is not out of the question that California could be installing Governor Larry Elder come September 14th, depending on how this recall turns out.
White supremacy is the sickness.
The Food and Drug Administration has now fully approved a COVID vaccine. It's the one from Pfizer, which, like other vaccines, had only emergency use authorization up to now. President Biden would like unvaccinated Americans to draw a conclusion.
So let me say this loudly and clearly. If you're one of the millions of Americans who said that they will not get the shot until it has full and final approval of the FDA, it has now happened. The moment you've been waiting for is here. It's time for you to go get your vaccination and get it today. Today. It's an important moment in our fight against the pandemic.
Dr. Francis Collins joins us once again. He is director of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Steve, on a day where we have some good news.
Well, let's talk about that news. I assume that full FDA approval is a higher standard of proof than the emergency authorization from late last year. So what does the FDA know now that they didn't know late last year?
Well, they've been able to look now over many more months of follow-up in terms of assessing both the safety and also the efficacy of this vaccine in the real world. They've pored over hundreds of thousands of pages of material from Pfizer about every detail, about every participant in the trials. They've learned more details about the manufacturing process. They've actually sent inspection teams to the places where the vaccine is being manufactured to be sure everything is exactly the way it's supposed to. And they have pronounced this all in order and hence the full approval. And as the president said a minute ago, that means if you're one of those folks who was waiting for that to be sure that this vaccine was going to be okay, that day has come.
I guess we can also just point out the obvious here, to put it in simple terms, many tens of millions of people went ahead of you across that bridge and the bridge didn't fall, so to speak.
Exactly. And they're actually in a much better place because of it. So, yeah, there's about 85 million Americans, Steve, that are still on the fence, have not yet gotten that first dose. The hope of many of us is that this will be a motivation for those folks to decide to go forward, because polls had said that was an issue for at least, 3 out of 10. And now the 3 out of 10, I hope they're listening right now, will decide to go to vaccines.gov, find out where the closest place is to get their immunization, and do it today.
Well, you must have had time to think about or been forced to think about the psychology of all this. You're absolutely correct. According to polls, a lot of people said they were awaiting final FDA approval to act. But what people say and what they mean is not always identical. Do you believe that final approval was the reason that some people hesitated?
Well, I hesitate to second-guess human behavior because I'm always wrong, but I think that was a factor in there, amongst others, of course. And unfortunately, a lot of the resistance is also based upon misinformation or disinformation that is so widely spread across the internet. But maybe this would be a good day for people who have held back to kind of hit the reset button and say, okay, let's really look at the facts here about why I might want to take advantage of this safe and effective vaccine, both for myself, for my family, and to help protect the people around me, because it's up to all of us to do that too.
Does this approval make it easier for federal, state, and local leaders who want to mandate more vaccinations?
Well, it already has. Within hours of the announcement, several universities, Minnesota, Louisiana, have moved forward. They said they were waiting for this. They didn't wait long to act upon it. Some businesses as well. And, of course, the military now with the announcement that the 1.2 million military individuals will be required to be vaccinated. Timetable not yet stated, but presumably soon. So I think you're going to see a lot of that in the next few days of those industries. Universities, other organizations that were kind of waiting because they wanted to be sure they were on the firmest possible footing to step forward and say, we're going to require this now.
Dr. Collins, let me raise a question that is constantly on the minds of every household, and I live in one, where there is somebody under 12 who currently cannot be vaccinated. How soon can we expect approval of vaccines for kids under 12?
No, Steve, I know a lot of people are really anxious to see this move forward. It's a difficult situation because kids under 12 are not just little miniature human beings. They have differences in their metabolism, their immune system. So, for instance, the question, what's the dose you ought to give? Do you give the same dose to a six-year-old as you would to somebody who's 30? Probably need to look at that. So the companies, Pfizer, Moderna, are working hard on collecting data from rigorous trials to be sure they've got that part right. But actually, the data hasn't been submitted to FDA yet. Pfizer thinks maybe by the end of September they'll be ready to send in their trial data, and then FDA will have to review it. I got to be honest, I don't see the approval for kids 5 to 11 coming much before the end of 2021.
Okay, well, it's helpful to know that because there had been stories suggesting maybe in September, but you're saying the data may get in September. That means that millions of parents are going to be sending their kids under 12 to school, in-person school. There might be masks, there might not be masks, but there are not going to be vaccines. Should parents worry about that? Or maybe I should say, how much should we worry about that?
Well, of course, we should worry about everything when it comes to COVID and especially with Delta. But there are mitigation methods to try to reduce the risk. Gosh knows, we all want to get the kids back in school to have that in-person experience for learning, for socialization. We ought to be doing everything we can to make that possible safely. This is why I'm just so puzzled about the big fight about masks in the schoolroom. If you want to avoid having that outbreak that's going to send all the kids home again, you should be doing everything to avoid that, and that means wearing masks. My understanding, when you talk to students, they seem a little less worried about wearing a mask than some of their parents. It just makes good sense. And by the way, if somebody tries to tell you we don't really have scientific evidence to say that masks reduce infection in schools, that's just not true. There are dozens of publications, both from the U.S. and other countries, to show that's the case. So, boy, I wish we could get over that fight. That one is really getting in the way of what is going to be a tough enough fall as it is.
Dr. Collins, thanks for the update. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health.
You dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West. All the superpowers. Everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir.
Oh, come on. Don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
The Delta variant is ravaging the continent of Africa. ICU beds and oxygen are in desperately short supply. Vaccines are increasingly scarce, with less than 10% of people expected to be vaccinated by the end of the year. Special correspondent Isabel Nakiria begins in Kampala, Uganda.
Assumpta Bahenda has been trying to wash away her near-death experience for 2 months now. She suffered from a severe case of COVID-19 in June.
I started feeling like I was going to die.
An ambulance evacuated her more than 170 miles from western Uganda to the capital, Kampala, but finding a bed in a hospital was almost impossible. With damaged lungs, Assumpta needed immediate admission to an ICU. When she finally found a bed in a private hospital, oxygen wasn't short supply.
There's a moment where they were rationing oxygen. They come and remove the oxygen from you and take it to someone who is struggling.
Uganda is going through a severe second wave. When cases shot up, the lucky few got beds when a patient died. It seems almost everyone lost someone close to them.
They told me your friend has gone, but you have to fight for your life.
Public hospitals across Uganda ran out of personal protective equipment during the height of the pandemic in June. Irene Nakasita managed to get a hospital bed some 25 miles out of the capital, but there were no doctors on hand to monitor her deteriorating condition.
I said, I can't take chances with my life anymore. I need to get out of the facility, whether discharged or not. Because I'd actually not seen any professional doctor walk to me to support me throughout. There were only nurses.
The limited supply of vaccines is another issue. Assumpta and Irene had received only one dose of COVID-19 vaccine and were waiting to get their second doses when they were infected. Uganda has vaccinated just about 1% of its population of 40 million. So far, it's received less than 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines, not nearly enough to vaccinate half the population, which it says it wants to do before fully reopening the economy. Cases are soaring in neighboring Tanzania, but it's open for business. The country's former president, John Magufuli, who died in office in March, was skeptical of the virus. He downplayed the risks of COVID-19 and even shunned mask wearing in favor of healing prayers and traditional herbal remedies. But under a new president, Tanzania has made a dramatic turnaround and reversed policies on COVID-19. It started to release data on coronavirus infections. And Tanzania is now ramping up vaccinations with its first shipments of vaccines from the United Nations Global COVAX program.
My fellow Tanzanians, I thank all of you who are here today to support me and show Tanzanians that the vaccine is not a disaster.
But not all Tanzanians are signing on. Sylvia Senya spent 22 days in emergency care with COVID-19 and almost lost her unborn baby. She's not convinced the vaccines are safe.
I will wait. I won't get the jab right now.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, despite increasing cases of the coronavirus, there's growing skepticism and deep mistrust of vaccines. The country has returned more than a million vaccine doses donated by the African Union because so many Congolese have refused to get the shots. Many people have taken false messaging and conspiracy theories to heart.
The COVID-19 vaccine has been rejected by most Congolese and some foreigners for a good reason. The spirits of our ancestors are using it to punish whites. It is something that we don't fully understand, but the goal of those foreigners is to destroy Africa.
Some passengers I've met have warned me against taking the COVID-19 vaccine. They keep telling me that I will die after getting the jab. Many people have told me the same thing, so I've decided not to take it.
Public hospitals in the DRC's capital, Kinshasa, are ill-equipped. The country battled the Ebola epidemic for years, depleting its healthcare system. Hospitals are running out of protective gear, but some health workers are determined to keep taking the risks to save lives. Dr. Emily Leboge came to work even after contracting COVID-19.
I had a fever and decided to treat it with acetaminophen, but I had to keep on working because the community and the COVID-19 unit needed me.
In West Africa, in Nigeria, the highly transmissible Delta variant is setting off a spike in daily coronavirus infections, and the number of actual cases may be much higher than reported, signaling the start of a third wave, says Dr. Emmanuel Okpetu.
When you look at the population of 200 million plus, we have not still tested enough. So it is possible we have a lot of missed cases.
South Africa has reported the highest number of cases and the highest number of deaths from COVID-19 in Africa. It also has one of the highest vaccination rates on the continent at 6%, but it's still far from the target. University of Cape Town researcher Benjamin Kajina says access to vaccines is vital.
As long as we have this problem of inequity and access to vaccines, it means that the virus will be somewhere out there circulating.
Africa has vaccinated just 2.5% of its 1.3 billion population, despite a surge in cases, with most of the countries depending on donations from wealthy nations. The U.S. recently donated millions of dollars to Nigeria and South Africa. India played a major role in bringing in millions of doses, but the country put a stop to vaccine exports for its own domestic use in April. African Union envoy on vaccine acquisition Strive Masiyiwa is pushing diplomats to release vaccines.
Those are being politically restricted. It's not the manufacturers, but it's political.
Despite promises from more wealthy nations to send vaccines to Africa, more than 80% of the doses have gone to people in high-income and upper-middle-income countries. The WHO says most people in the poorest countries will need to wait another 2 years before vaccines are available to them. For now, for Assumpta and millions of other Africans, the deck seems stacked. They will keep waiting for their vaccines while new waves of COVID-19 sweep across the continent, putting their lives at risk. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Isabel Nakiria in Kampala.
The COVID is spreading, particularly most of the numbers are with the unvaccinated, and the Democrats like to blame Republicans on that. Well, the biggest group in most states are African Americans who have not been vaccinated. The last time I checked, over 90% of them vote for Democrats in their major cities and major counties.
The Delta variant continues to drive up the rate of new coronavirus infections and hospitalizations, and deaths are also steadily increasing. The New York Times tracking project shows more than 90,000 patients are hospitalized nationwide, and more than 900 deaths from COVID-19 are being reported on average each day, twice as many as at the beginning of this month. Many states with low vaccination rates are reporting the highest number of new cases. Vaccinations are effective at preventing and limiting symptoms. Globally, the COVID pandemic is surging to its highest level since May, with an average of more than 650,000 new cases reported daily over the past week. In Australia today, protests against lockdowns turned violent. The measures are in effect in several regions where coronavirus cases are rising. Several thousand people clashed with police in Melbourne, and there were hundreds of arrests. Under Australia's restrictions, people are mostly confined to their homes and allowed only limited social interactions. In May, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention made a decision to reduce the tracking of breakthrough COVID infections to only those involving hospitalizations and deaths. That leaves public health officials without the full data that can answer questions as the new Delta variant spreads. I spoke with Jessica Malati Rivera, an infectious disease epidemiologist and research fellow at Boston Children's Hospital. Jessica, thanks for joining us. You used to work with the COVID tracking project. When you hear the CDC is no longer tracking all of these breakthrough cases, what do you think of that?
You know, to be completely honest, it's heartbreaking. By not tracking breakthrough data with as much granularity as we would hope, we are just basically creating blind spots in our understanding of the true impact of the virus, especially the variants that are circulating so widely in the United States.
Why did the CDC, as best you understand, adopt a policy like this?
You know, I don't know, actually. I've yet to see a really explicit explanation. I've heard rumors of things like lack of resources, lack of funding, lack of staff. But to me, it seems pretty, from an epidemiology standpoint, not defensible.
Is there something that should be done, such as encouraging people perhaps to self-report? And if they did, to whom?
You know, I'm aware of a few research groups and a few universities that are still tracking that information. And It's better than nothing. But at this point, one of the biggest issues that we saw throughout the pandemic was the lack of data infrastructure and even systems that can collect this data and speak to each other so that we can have a kind of broad understanding of what's happening. If you look back at how states were tasked with collecting COVID-19 data, they all kind of had to fend for themselves. They all had different systems of reporting. They all had different dashboards with different formats. So we're dealing with, once again, between vaccine data and breakthrough data, very, very disparate systems of data collection and data reporting.
What are we missing here? What are we missing out on?
We're missing a lot of details. We're missing a lot of opportunities to get ahead of new variants that are emerging. We're getting, so many questions from people anecdotally about, you know, their experiences with breakthrough infections or breakthrough transmission, which is not actually that surprising. I mean, we knew that the vaccines were not 100% effective. Breakthrough infections were expected. So we could have had a chance, though, to get ahead of that. We could have also had a chance to get ahead of some of the policy shifts that kind of set us back a bit. And I'm thinking specifically back in May when we kind of prematurely encouraged folks who were vaccinated to take their masks off. And I think if we had this kind of data, or if we had this kind of detail to what we would expect with regard to transmission, we could have calibrated everybody's expectations a bit better.
Explain what your work at the tracking project, the COVID tracking project, did. And does that make you feel even more strongly now that all of these cases at least make an attempt to track them?
You know, the COVID tracking project was a really remarkable group of mostly volunteers who collected testing, case, hospitalization, and death data from 56 states and jurisdictions, and it was done manually. We would collect that data from state dashboards, we would synthesize it, analyze it, and report it, and share it freely and publicly because we felt very strongly that this data belonged to the people. And we did that kind of in the absence of that detail coming from the CDC. We have since stopped that data collection as of March 7th, and, you know, there are many of us who are alum of that network who are grieved by this kind of repeat situation that we're in. We started because there was an absence of data, and here we are again over a year later with yet another absence of data that is causing us to kind of operate in the dark.
Does this leave us then with a lack of understanding of this virus?
It really does, because we know that viruses mutate, we know that variants can emerge, and we know that that can especially happen in the context of having a large percentage of the population unvaccinated. We've just hit the 51% mark of people in the United States being fully vaccinated. That presents a vulnerability for us, and we know that variants like Delta emerged in the absence of vaccines in India, and we expect for that to continue to happen. And so in an effort to get ahead of new variants that are emerging, in an effort to understand kind of the continued efficacy of these vaccines, we need that data. Now, we do have some data that has proven that these vaccines are still very effective against the Delta variant. But now, as you've seen in the headlines, we're talking about boosters because we want to ensure that we are not allowing people who get vaccinated to have any possible additional risk of having severe outcomes.
Why were we dropping mask mandates when we knew that these breakthrough cases were happening?
It's a great question, Michael. I wish I had an answer to that that made sense. I think in many ways, you know, some of these public health policies are intended to kind of reward people for a job well done, getting vaccinated, bearing through this really difficult time. But it was premature. I will stand by that, forever on that statement, because I do think that we have to recognize that public health mitigation is never one thing. It's never a silver bullet solution. And we've failed to recognize still that we can't even look at vaccines that way too. It's always additive. It's always layered. So it's vaccines plus masking, plus distancing, plus reducing your risk, plus recognizing that individual choices have community consequences sometimes. So I think we've learned that lesson the hard way, and we've had to kind of backtrack on those messages. And you're seeing a lot of policies change on small levels and even possibly national levels to kind of mitigate that premature decision.
Jessica Malata Rivera is an infectious disease epidemiologist and a research fellow at Boston Children's Hospital. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
The third wave. Like a trickster, the newest variant of COVID-19 has emerged just in time to dash the hopes of over a dozen states, especially those with the highest unvaccinated populations. Across the South and in Western states, infection rates have risen to dangerous levels. So have hospitalizations. Even Wall Street has responded with fear and trepidation as stocks have taken a tumble. journalists now write and speak of a new surge in COVID cases, mostly among the unvaccinated, but among the vaccinated as well. Few have expected this course of events, but here we are. How things have changed. Texas, Arkansas, and Florida have become COVID hotspots, but they are not alone. This resurgence of COVID proves once again that politicians make poor physicians. They have left their people badly unprotected in a time of pandemic disease. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
As kids go back to school, they are already bringing home COVID-19. Even a mild pediatric case can derail an entire family. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED reports on some who have recently weathered the turmoil.
A few weeks ago, Stephanie Chouinard's son Desmond lost his appetite, and then he developed a fever. She grimaced when he tested positive for COVID-19.
When I told him, I said, sweetheart, you have COVID, he just burst out into tears.
The family canceled a long-awaited summer trip to Lake Tahoe. Instead, they quarantined at home in the Bay Area,
notifying everyone that I had been in contact with.
She called her son's summer camp. They shut it down. She called the public pool. The hardest call was to a friend who had just had an organ transplant.
A moral failing, it felt like. That might be a lot of me internalizing that, but we've all been bathed in anxiety for the last year and a half.
Fortunately, her son Desmond's case was mild. His fever broke the same day it started.
Desmond was only sick for 8 hours, but I've spent 45 hours on notifications alone.
And of course, the family had to quarantine, which meant juggling work and childcare. Still, Chouinard and her husband didn't catch the virus. They're both vaccinated. Some families aren't so lucky.
My name is Jace Garcia, and I'm 11 years old.
Jace caught COVID playing soccer with a friend in Sacramento.
I've never felt anything like this.
The virus struck in the middle of the night. Jace woke up vomiting uncontrollably. Body aches racked his slim calves, chest, head.
Everything was feeling like something was just squeezing that part of the body towards the bone.
Jace's fever spiked at 104. He shivered under blankets. He couldn't even distract himself with video games.
Every time I would click down, I would get like a tingling sensation in my hand. I want to go back to sleep. My hands are starting to hurt. I'm getting a little dizzy.
The only advice doctors offered was try to stay hydrated.
You can't really breathe. I can't feel like I can get better.
Sure enough, 4 days after my son got it, I tested positive that morning.
That's Rico Garcia, Jace's dad. He'd been vaccinated.
It felt like a terrible head cold. My brain was foggy. I couldn't think straight. I started losing my voice.
Which made it impossible to work. He's a DJ. Then one morning at breakfast.
My first sip of coffee was amazing. My 9th or 10th sip tasted like hot water. I mean, it was just the snap of a finger and my sense of taste and smell was gone. I went as far as to cut a lime open and bite into it, tasted nothing.
Rico's son, Jace, is still fighting a lingering cough and congestion. And he's missing the first 10 days of 6th grade. His mom also caught the virus. She's a teacher and isn't back in class either. About 100,000 kids are catching COVID each week. But less than 2% of pediatric cases require hospitalization. As schools open and more students test positive, parents and teachers are trying to weigh the risk. Last year was hard on kids.
Young people were experiencing more depression, anxiety because of the level of isolation.
Santoy Trotter is a psychotherapist at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland.
One element of their well-being is being with peers, learning, stretching, struggling, growing, connecting.
Kids are excited for art class, band practice, plays. Jace Garcia is missing rehearsals for a show that's been on hold.
It was a musical he's waited a few years to be a part of. Fingers crossed they'll still find a way to have him involved.
Jace is hoping he can catch a few performances. For NPR News, I'm Leslie McClurg in San Francisco.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Local school boards across the country have had to deal with the wrath of parents angry about mask requirements. That's because in many states, local officials and health departments are leaving that decision up to school board members. As WFYI's Farah Yusri reports, that is adding stress for people who join the school board out of a sense of civic duty.
Elaine Murphy is in her 60s. She is slender, with short blonde hair and green eyes. She lives in New Albany, a small city in southern Indiana. Her home is lined with family pictures.
This is Hazel, my oldest granddaughter. She's 10 now. And then the baby there is Everly.
Murphy has served schools here her entire career. She's now the president of the local school board. And she says it used to be that school board meetings here were low-key. But no more.
You know, we're making decisions now that, you know, 2 years ago, you'd be like, what? You know, a pandemic, what?
Still, nothing prepared her for the last boisterous and confrontational school board meeting.
I move that we have
nearly 200 recess. People filled the hall. Some carried big flags and signs that read, "My body, my choice." Emotions were raw.
It's sad to say that, you know, now when I see someone come in with a flag and a flagpole, I'm thinking, well, that's a potential weapon. I've seen that before.
The day of the meeting, Murphy's son, Ryan Gunnerman, drove 2 hours from Bloomington to be with her.
I wanted to take her in my car. I didn't want the protesters to see her in her car. And we went in the side entrance.
A few days later, infection rates surged and the school district required masks. Now, Murphy keeps a baseball bat next to the door at home. In many states, it's school board members who are on the front lines, and that's taking a toll. Charlie Wilson in Worthington, Ohio, is the past president of the National School Boards Association and is a school board member himself. He says it's become so partisan that any decision he makes is deemed political.
Literally daily getting hate emails and sometimes phone calls, and frankly, occasionally people knocking on my door and, you know, threatening to do all kinds of things.
Most of these people are Wilson's neighbors and former friends.
And so literally, I was waking up at nights dreaming about a child losing a parent or a loved one because of a virus that the child got at school.
Wilson does not plan to run for office again. Vladimir Kogan studies state and local government at The Ohio State University. He says school boards had to weather heated partisan debates like school prayer and sex ed. But this time around, things are a bit more intense.
I think it's exactly this idea of blame shifting, that no matter what you do, you're going to piss somebody off. So you'd rather another entity or another official make that call and get the blame from whoever is mad.
Kogan and others say guidance since the start of the pandemic has been evolving, and some parents are understandably concerned and confused. Layer that with political tribalism, and you get something of a perfect storm facing school board members all across the country. For NPR News, I'm Farah Yusri.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
A school board in Oregon recently took on calls for racial justice by passing a rule that teachers and staff are not allowed to wear or display Black Lives Matter signs or gay pride flags at school. Katie O'Riddle reports.
It began with one Black Lives Matter poster hung in an elementary school. Some parents in this Portland exurb called Newburgh objected. Things snowballed, and weeks later, School Board Vice Chair Brian Shannon was at the school board meeting asking for a vote on this measure.
Direct the superintendent to remove all Black Lives Matter in all instances of the symbol known as the pride flag from district facilities immediately.
It was approved with a 4-3 vote. Under the rule, the only political symbols or flags allowed in the school would be the state and U.S. flags.
What the school board is doing here is unlawful.
Kelly Simon is with the ACLU of Oregon. She says there's a lot that's still unclear about this rule and ambiguity about how it might apply to students.
Both students and teachers don't lose all of their First Amendment protections when they enter the school.
Simon and her colleagues are working with community organizers to fight the ban, and the superintendent has said it can't be enforced until there's more clarity around its legality. What is clear is that its passage has galvanized an unprecedented amount of civic engagement in this town of less than 25,000 people.
I'll tell you what, I'm not a racist.
Dave Brown is the Newburgh School Board Chair. He voted for the ban.
I'll coach anybody, anywhere, any type of kid. I'll teach them. I'll work with them. I'll live next door to them.
Brown's been coaching the high school tennis team here for 23 years. He says he thinks the new rule will help kids learn and not be distracted by divisive politics. Fellow school board member Renee Powell also voted for the ban. She holds a stack of letters from community members.
Here's another one. It said, I'm a senior attending Newburgh High School.
Powell says she met with many people who are afraid to publicly express their support for the ban, like this student whose letter she reads.
Having all that political and LGBTQ stuff shoved in my face at school makes me feel uncomfortable.
Ty Harden Moore and her family are part of the very small Black community here. Moore says one student's discomfort is worth the trade-off for the sense of security a Black Lives Matter sign offers to students like her son. She says her son has been called the N-word in school.
People walk through their entire lives being uncomfortable because of how society treats them.
The ban has motivated her to run for school board. She's not the only one planning the resistance.
So first and foremost, I want to say a huge thank you for being here.
Community organizer Kristen Stoller is leading parents, students, and activists to strategize. They've gathered on the back patio at a local pizza shop called Honey Pie Pizza to introduce themselves.
My name's Cooper Oaks, and it kind of sucks knowing that I'm attending a school that is kind of showing that it has no respect for me or my peers.
Oaks has publicly identified as queer since seventh grade. Reed Arnold is another of the students here. He'll be a senior next year.
Seeing those flags, if it's in a teacher's room or in the hallway, it's reassurance.
Arnold came here from his job at Burgerville. He's still wearing his name tag. These flags in schools, he says, are a kind of silent code of support for vulnerable students.
And so having them taken away, it's like walking through a war zone.
Arnold says he was feeling excited for his little sister, who will be in her first year of high school next year. But lately he feels more like he'll need to help protect her. For NPR News, I'm Katie Riddle in Newburgh, Oregon.
I mean, but they would rather have a system where a person just gets their fun and glory and profit out of mistreating somebody. Because that's all racism is. That's all, you know, it's all just mistreatment. That's all. That's the key word. I ain't happy unless I'm mistreating somebody.
Mm.
That's the philosophy of white supremacy.
Wow. Wow. Wow. Wow. I mean, that's just so radically different.
I'm going to tell a nigga joke. Why? Because it makes the nigga feel bad. Makes me feel good.
But most white people don't do that anymore. That's, you know, that's old hat. They don't do that anymore. They, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know. I mean, they've done so much of it. I mean, they've made us a joke. I mean, so, you know.
Wow. I mean, that's just... Nobody. I don't hear hardly anyone.
But
that...
they still do the mistreatment. See, I mean, they're just always looking for new ways to mistreat. You know, is there any way we can mistreat these people? You know, hey, I mean, it's getting dull around here.
Wow.
Ride a riding horseback and, you know, pitch his horseshoes and, you know... Going up to Sturgis, Kentucky, I mean, you know, and burning all the rub off of motorcycles and whatnot. No. Sturgis, what? Sturgis, Utah, I think it is. Where, Idaho, that's where it is. Where they have all that bicycle, motorcycle conventions every year.
Hmm.
White guys. They show it on television. go up there and get drunk and raise saying there ain't no black people around, whatnot, see? But, you know, that's why it don't take long, see? That's they got to get back to business. You know?
Let's turn now to South Dakota, where COVID cases are once again surging after hundreds of thousands of people gathered earlier this month for the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. The surge comes after health officials there were seeing some of the lowest numbers since the pandemic began. Monument Health, a hospital group in the southwestern part of the state, was even getting ready to declare its first day of zero COVID patients. Instead, hospitals are, once again, overwhelmed. Joining us now is Dr. Shankar Kora, Vice President of Medical Affairs for Monument Health. He joins us from Rapid City. Hi there. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Mary Lewis.
How bad is the COVID situation where you are? What are you seeing in your hospitals?
Yeah, it is pretty bad and dire. Those are the best words to describe it. You know, last year when we were in June, cases. This year, we were way better than last year, and at one point just had about 3 patients, COVID patients. And then once we got into late July and August through now, we are currently about 77 patients in the inpatient setting from COVID. So that's a dramatic rise in cases.
Wow. Well, but there's a little bit of a glitch on your line, so I'll just repeat those numbers because they are stunning. I believe you just told us you were at a point where you had 3 COVID patients, and then within a month or two, you're up to 77 COVID patients in your hospital.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
All right. Well, what do we know about the why? Can we draw a direct line? Do we know this spike was caused by or at least partly caused by the Sturgis rally?
Yeah, the conclusion can be made. We know that we had no cases almost in June and July until we had about 500,000 people from various states show up. And some of the testing we've done here locally shows that as well, you know, from states such as Texas, Florida, California, Wyoming, and we've had positives. So it is only natural that the disease comes from other hot spots, and we were not a hot spot all through June and July.
And we should just explain for people who don't know Sturgis, haven't been to Sturgis, haven't seen videos of it. It's several hundred thousand people packed in. It's mostly outside, but packed in shoulder to shoulder. They take this big mass photo every day. This is, you know, the kind of worst case scenario, I guess, for transmission, particularly when we have the Delta variant circulating so widely.
Yes, and we know how SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, spreads. It usually depends on what are called super spreader events. And the fact that we had 500,000 people show up in the Black Hills in August, early August, has directly contributed to this rise that we're seeing.
Well, this can't be a total surprise, right? Last year, the Sturgis rally was held, and afterward it was found that specific event had led to widespread transmission, including a bunch of cases in states beyond South Dakota that were traced back to Sturgis. Were there calls this year not to hold the rally or to modify it in some way?
No, there were no calls. And last year, the city of Sturgis considered it, but this year, you know, everyone's given up, and it's considered a unstoppable event. That is quite unfortunate because there were no mitigation or suppression measures. And so the virus, as you well know, all it needs is a person-to-person spread, especially the Delta variant with twice the transmission speed as the original Alpha.
When you say everyone has just given up, explain the idea being this is a rally that is just the politics and the optics are just not there to call it off.
Yeah, it's inevitable that the bike enthusiasts would come from all over the country. And so the city is in a way, there for these folks to come and visit.
That is Dr. Shankar Kora of Monument Health in South Dakota. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
We have had a relatively good history of looking at suicide in Native American, American Indian populations, because there's high rates there as well. But specifically Black Americans, the rates have been going up faster than they have in white Americans, but we're recognizing more and more that risk for suicide is up there and increasing for black Americans, especially younger black males. In the white population, we see suicides more in middle age and sort of very old, like after 85. But the risk period is highest for black Americans around age 20. And that's arguably much more tragic to lose someone so young.
A heads up that our next story is about suicide, and it may be distressing to some listeners. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed a lot of cracks in American life. Things like pay disparities, housing and job security, racism. A lot of these realities became a lot more dire, though, over the last year and a half. And alongside this, another crisis has been bubbling up. Suicide rates in communities of color are rising, especially in Black, Hispanic, and Asian populations. Experts say it's not a coincidence that the pandemic has exposed this issue, but the suicide rates were increasing before COVID-19. So how does the country tackle this problem? This crisis is covered in a new report by my guest. Aneri Patani covers mental health and substance use for Kaiser Health News. She's based in Raleigh, North Carolina. Aneri, welcome to Science Friday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about these statistics that we have for this rise in suicides in communities of color. How much of a rise are we talking about, and how long has this been going on?
Nationally, there's data from the CDC that shows that there's been a steady increase in suicide deaths among communities of color since the early to mid-2010s. So there's this study by the National Institute of Mental Health that found between 2014 and 2019, the suicide rate increased 30% for Black individuals and 16% for Asian or Pacific Islander individuals. And when you drill down into specific age groups, that data goes back further and is more concerning. So for Black teens, from 2001 to 2017, the suicide rate increased 60% for boys and 182% for girls. And what's particularly notable is that the rates continue rising for communities of color, even when they fall for white Americans. So in 2019, the national suicide rate dropped for the first time in more than a decade. And this was a big deal. But when you drill down into that data, the drop was driven by a decrease in suicides among white Americans, while the rates kept going up for communities of color. And it seems like the same might be true during 2020, the first year of the pandemic.
And these age demographics hold true as well. These numbers often skew younger than suicides among white people.
Yeah. So for communities of color, the age group that's at highest risk for suicide over most of these years has been adolescents and young adults. And in some cases for Black Americans, there's even research showing that suicide rates among kids younger than 13 are going up too. Versus for white Americans, your highest risk group tends to be middle age and older adults.
So for many years, as you've said, suicide rates have been highest among white middle-aged men. Is this something that is changing?
Not exactly. So here we get into the nuances a little bit of how we look at the data. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about in any single year, who has the highest number of suicide deaths or highest suicide rate per capita, that is still going to be middle-aged white American men. However, if you look at trends over time, you see that suicides are increasing among young people of color faster. And even in the years that the suicide rate drops for white Americans, they continue increasing for people of color. So when I'm talking to researchers, you know, certainly they say more needs to be done to address the suicide rate among white Americans, but they're also concerned about this initial increasing trend, and they want to draw attention to communities of color and suicide before we wait for that rate to get up to where it is for white Americans.
Let's talk a bit about the possible reasons for why this crisis is happening right now in communities of color. In reporting this story, what are some common threads that you found?
Let me start off by saying that suicide is a complex issue, and there's not one single factor that causes it. And it's also really hard to study because the person who could answer the question as to why is not there. Still, there are some trends that researchers mentioned to me, you know, so over the last decade, there's been a lot of economic instability, and there's tons of research that links loss of jobs or lack of job prospects to suicide risk. There's also been a widening in the racial wealth gap. So we're talking about disproportionately affecting communities of color with poverty, with unsafe housing conditions, all of these risk factors also linked to suicide. And then there's also been more public attention on police killings of Black and brown people. And there have been many studies out there that show that that affects not just the mental health of the people who know the individual who died or was shot, but the community at large. And so these factors coming together can lead to hopelessness and increased suicide risk.
So just to clarify, is there a way to determine the reasons for this rise in suicides, or is this just really speculation for now?
So there are studies that can be done where researchers would interview the family and friends of people who died by suicide and try to really pinpoint for each case, you know, what pieces may have come together that led to the death. But those studies are expensive and they're really time consuming, so they're not done that often. I know some are being done to look at the suicide deaths in 2020 during the pandemic, but obviously we don't have those results yet.
Well, speaking of that, your story does note that this trend was happening before the pandemic. Maybe you can talk a bit more about that. Are some of the reasons the same pre-pandemic and now?
So researchers are still looking into that, but there definitely seems to be some overlap. During the pandemic, researchers saw disparities in suicide by race and thought, you know, what are the factors that could be at play here? There's the fact that communities of color were disproportionately affected by COVID. They lost loved ones, which causes a lot of grief. They lost jobs, lost housing, faced food insecurity, all of which could have contributed to that increased suicide rate. But a lot of these factors were also disproportionately affecting communities of color before the pandemic. And so they are thinking, you know, it could have been those same factors that were affecting the rising rate beforehand, too. But really, they need a lot more research to figure out if that's the case for sure.
So it's really important to point out here that your story is not about the COVID pandemic causing this rise in suicide amongst people of color.
Absolutely. So this is something that has been going on. Some studies will look at it since the 90s. Definitive national data shows it from the mid-2010s. So this is another one of those things where this was already happening and COVID just put a spotlight on the fact that it was existing.
I want to hear the voices of some of the people that you talked to. And one of the threads that you were pulling in your reporting is people saying to you, you know, we just really don't talk about that. We don't talk about suicide. And I have a clip here from Kathy Williams, a mom from Durham, North Carolina, who you talked to for your story. Her son, Torian, died by suicide in 1996. And she told you that she didn't know what signs to look for. She only learned afterwards when she looked for information about suicide.
And that was when the presenter was going over, you know, the signs and symptoms of depression and suicide, I started checking them off. I said, oh my goodness, I saw that. I saw that. Oh, I saw that. I saw that. And I said, that was Torian.
It seems as though she's talking about not just not talking about suicide, but not talking a lot about the underlying mental health issues. Maybe you can talk a bit more about Kathy and what she's trying to do for her community.
So after Kathy lost her son, Torian, she really channeled that pain into a mission, right? So her mission now is to not let any other parents miss those warning signs because they don't know what to look for. So after her son passed, she, you know, listened to these presentations, took mental health trainings, went to conferences, did research, and really wanted to bring that learning back to her community. So she started presenting at her son's high school, at her church in Durham, and telling people, you know, what are the signs to look for, in the hopes that no one else misses it. And also in the hopes that, you know, at the time she told me, people thought suicide was a white issue. And in her community, you know, Black people didn't talk about suicide. And she was hoping she could get that ball rolling so that no one else would be in the situation that she was in.
What other resources are available in some of the communities where you were doing your reporting, though? Because Kathy and people like her can only do so much.
Absolutely. So over time, a lot of groups have actually sprung up to bring awareness and education on this issue. So there's the National Organization for People of Color Against Suicide. And this was actually started by a woman named Donna Barnes, who's Black, and she lost her son to suicide in 1990, so around the same time as Kathy. There's also the ACOMA project, which focuses on researching and preventing suicide and depression, specifically in youth of color. And at the college level, there's the STEVE Fund, which is dedicated to mental health concerns for university students of color. And of course, there are a ton more in sort of local areas, but those are some of the ones that I came across in my reporting.
I want to turn to talking specifically about the Asian American community right now. Asian American young adults are the only racial group where suicide is the leading cause of death. Do we know why this is?
Such an important question, and unfortunately the short answer is no. We don't know why this is. Despite the fact that the suicide rate is rising among this group and it's really high for adolescents, there is shockingly little data and research on Asian Americans. Actually, less than 1% of federal research funding goes to any health research, including suicide, focused on that group. So the little that we do know suggests that maybe, you know, the model minority myth, this idea that Asian Americans are smart and successful and don't need help, could impede people from seeking care. But in reality, we need to learn a lot more. Actually, one of the researchers I spoke with compared it to, we used to think that, you know, Black Americans are not impacted by suicide, she told me. But then we started funding research into that area and we looked at the data broken apart and we saw that actually suicide among Black youth is increasing at a really alarming rate. So what might we find if we actually fund that research into Asian American youth?
And so then they knew they had to teach the people of color to hate themselves, because if they taught the people of color, promoted valuing themselves as people of color, loving themselves, respecting themselves, and respecting one another, then the people would never submit to domination. So you have to train them that they're ugly and they look like the devil, and give them an image of God as white. And so you can thoroughly subjugate them. And then you program, once you teach them to hate themselves, then they will fight and kill one another.
In 2017, because of a court ruling, the Cherokee Nation granted citizenship to people known as freedmen. They are the descendants of people enslaved by the Cherokees. Now other tribes feel pressure to do the same, and Congress is getting involved. Here's Allison Herrera from KOSU in Tulsa.
At a small table near the back of the Midwest City Library, Lieta Osborne Sampson pulls out a census sheet from the late 1800s.
My great-great-grandmother, Minerva Maupins, was a medicine woman.
The sheet has all the names and some details about her family.
She taught my grandfather how to do the herbs and everything, but she helped take care of the people in the nation.
Sampson is carrying on the family legacy. She's a home health care worker and a band chief for the Seminole Nation Tribal Council. Even though she sits on the Tribal Council and votes on important tribal business, she says she can't receive any tribal benefits like housing or health care. That's because she doesn't have full citizenship.
So with our family, to tell me that I don't belong where I am is disrespectful.
Sampson is a Seminole freedman descendant. Freedmen were formerly enslaved people of the five tribes that were removed to Oklahoma from the southeast on the Trail of Tears. A quick history lesson. After the Civil War, these same five tribes signed treaties in 1866. As part of those treaties, tribal nations agreed to free their slaves and give them the same rights as other tribal citizens. To Sampson, that means citizenship into the Seminole Nation. She points back to that census.
So if you're on this here, and this is a census from 1898 to 1914, by blood, why are we having this problem today?
The Seminole Nation declined to be interviewed for this story, but says they are considering freedmen citizenship. Sampson's struggle was bolstered by the Cherokee Nation allowing freedmen into their tribe and more recent protests over racial injustice. Last month, she and other freedmen traveled to Washington, D.C. for a hearing on a key housing bill for Native Americans. They want language put in that legislation allowing them to receive benefits, just like other Seminole citizens do. The Seminole Nation says it comes down to sovereignty. They decide who is a citizen, not the U.S. government.
They've used lots of arguments, you know, this violates their sovereignty. These people are not part of our community. They don't contribute anything.
That's Michigan State University law professor Matthew Fletcher. He says the freedmen should be citizens, full stop.
The treaty requires the tribes to accept and enroll the freedmen.
Because of the bill in Washington, freedmen now have the attention of some of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, including House Committee on Financial Services Chairwoman Maxine Waters.
This is a fight that's about fairness and equality. For one minority group to discriminate against a minority group will cannot stand.
For Lieta Osborne Sampson, who is proud of her Seminole heritage, she says it's simple. She is and always has been part of the tribe.
But my grandfather had it on his wall. They said, as long as the rivers flow and the grass grow, that we are Seminoles. And we're talking about the freedmen.
The Seminole Nation just had an election, and Sampson hopes new leadership will finally grant her and all freedmen tribal citizenship. For NPR News, I'm Allison Herrera in Tulsa.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about? In Europe and in Germany. He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Possible destinations for Afghan refugees include Turkey. It's already home to some 4 million refugees, most of whom fled the war in Syria. But because Turkey does take in so many refugees, public opinion has been turning against new arrivals. Last month, a nationalist mob attacked the homes and businesses of Syrians in Turkey's capital city of Ankara. Dari Biskaran reports.
When the mob started breaking down windows and looting businesses in the neighborhood known as Little Aleppo, this shopkeeper and his wife gathered their kids in the hallway and turned out the lights. He described it through an interpreter.
He was telling his daughters that those people are bad people, they're thieves, and the police will come and take them away so that they don't learn to hate.
The riot started after a street brawl between Syrian and Turkish young men, in which a Turkish teenager died. So the shopkeeper knew that night that his family was in danger.
I'm okay to take a beating, but it's for my kids and my wife that I was very, very concerned.
This shopkeeper asked us not to use his name due to ongoing threats in the neighborhood. We met him at a restaurant on the other side of town. He says that by the time police controlled the rioters, dozens of businesses were damaged and looted. A health clinic for refugees was destroyed. Photos on social media show rioters holding up an ultra-nationalist hand signal.
Wherever we go, we're not wanted. The racism against refugees is everywhere.
A few days after the riot, police checkpoints monitor traffic in and out of the neighborhood. Stores are boarded up, windows are broken. Almost everyone stays off the street. To hear what Turkish residents think, I went to a park in central Ankara. It's green and lively as street musicians play for tips. I meet a Turkish university student. He doesn't want his name used because he has a job with a company that might not want him speaking out. But he says people in Turkey are hardening their stance against refugees because they blame them for the economy here getting worse.
It's a lot cheaper to make refugees work in industries. That's why people lose their job. And plus, people see them as a threat.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan initially welcomed Syrians. But political pressure is building against him and getting more intense with the prospect of Afghans fleeing the Taliban takeover of their country. This week, Erdogan said 300,000 Afghans currently live in Turkey. Turkey has ramped up construction on an extension of a wall along its eastern border with Iran, the route most Afghans take to get here. Ömer Özgözülcük is a policy analyst for SİDA, a pro-government Turkish think tank.
There is a quiet decisiveness inside Turkey to prevent new refugees from coming in.
So the door could be closing for Afghans. Even for Syrians who have been here for years, life remains difficult. You can't register a car without getting an M on your license plate, marking you as a foreigner. Can't answer the phone in public and risk speaking Arabic, says the shopkeeper who escaped the mob.
Even when our kids grow up, at some point, even if they get Turkish citizenship, they'll still be labeled as Syrians and refugees in Turkey.
He's thinking of moving to another city now to get his kids away from the bad memories. For NPR News, I'm Dari Biskaran in Ankara.
I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay. But we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers.
Floyd Ray Roseberry appeared for the first time in court Friday, seeming disoriented. He told the judge he needed his, quote, mind medicine and that he didn't know what day it is. This comes 24 hours after he sent a scare through the entire region and caused an evacuation of much of the U.S. Capitol complex, telling police he was parked outside the Library of Congress in a pickup truck filled with explosives, all while live streaming much of the ordeal on Facebook. The judge told Roseberry he was concerned he wouldn't be able to understand today's proceedings without his medication, but he read the charges against him anyway. Roseberry facing criminal counts of use or attempted use of an explosive device, which carries a maximum of 10 years in prison, and attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction, which carries a maximum of life in prison. Roseberry shut down sections of Capitol Hill yesterday as hostage negotiators tried to reason with the North Carolina man, who police said was later found to have explosive materials in his pickup truck, but not an assembled bomb, as he claimed. After hours of keeping law enforcement at bay and D.C. on edge, Roseberry finally emerged from his truck and was arrested. Right now, Roseberry is being held in a jail in the basement of MPD headquarters. Typically, the plan would be to transfer him here to the central detention facility here in D.C., but the Department of Justice has asked that he be sent for a mental competency hearing. Eric Fleck, WUSA 9.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
I was determined to get him, and that was really scary.
New at 11, a Tacoma family sharing terrifying moments after they say a six-year-old boy was nearly kidnapped by a woman armed with a machete and an axe. The family took a trip to Portland where they say the woman threatened them and used racial slurs.
Columbus Cole Miller is live with their story tonight. Cole?
It's a chilling story, Mary Preston. That boy's mother says she is still traumatized by all of this. They had gone out to grab a quick bite for lunch, and they quickly noticed that woman was standing behind them and acting strange, claiming their boy belonged to her, and then she threatened to kill them. On the hunt for a slice of pizza in downtown Portland this past weekend, a Tacoma family soon found themselves in a frightening position. A woman they had never met before eyeing their six-year-old son.
I don't know what it was. She just kept staring at him.
And it only got worse from there. As they walked away, Alex Perez says that woman followed them across the street, demanding they turn the boy over, even reaching for him, eventually pulling out a machete. Police sharing this photo of that weapon and another blade on social media.
He was definitely very scared. I mean, he couldn't stop crying. He was shaking. His heart was beating really fast.
The 37-year-old was arrested after Perez called police, and she's facing a number of charges, including bias crime. The family says she targeted their race with her words.
So she started yelling racial slurs, saying, yeah, run, N-word, run. She's like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. Give me my son back.
Now behind bars, the family hopes she's able to get the help that she needs.
They don't even know what to do with themselves when they get up in the morning, except what I tell them. Go here, go there. That's the only time they make sense. Other than that, they don't know anything. And proof of it is I can say, hey, I'm going to make some hats out of hubcaps. I got surplus hubcaps in my warehouse on some cars that I haven't even manufactured yet. And I don't know what to do with those surplus hubcaps. I don't want to throw them away. I got millions of them. But I got a bunch of black people out there who are just looking for something to do. They don't know what to do. They just look at this great big universe, the great big world. Look up and down the streets. They don't know what to do or where to go at any given moment. So I always, as usual, find something for them to do. So the next thing I'll do is the little money I've allowed them to have, I'm going to take these hubcaps that I ordinarily would put on some cars, and I'm going to say that they are no longer hubcaps, that they are hats. And I'll have all these millions of black people walking around with these hubcaps on their heads. And give it a fancy name like Zapsters. You know. And people will be asking, what's a Zapster? Hey, man, that's the new hats, man. I mean, you square. You don't know what's up. You don't know. You haven't bought you a Zapster yet? $800 a piece, man. I got two of them.
Yeah, if you just type in the hashtag Crate Challenge anywhere on your social media, within seconds, your feed's going to get flooded with hundreds of thousands of videos of people climbing up on top of plastic milk crates and likely falling to the ground shortly after. And many of those videos were even shot right here in Gresham Park. The Milk Crate Challenge has already climbed its way from TikTok into Atlanta's backyard. This video posted over the weekend from Gresham Park here in DeKalb County shows several people attempting to climb their way up a stack of wobbly milk crates. Many people are embarking on this risky climb, hoping the odds are stacked in their favor and that they may even score some cash from those who are actively betting they won't make it all the way up or down the pyramid without falling. But most videos are having the same horrific ending. People can be seen falling on their neck, back, and arms, even face first in some attempts that could be deadly.
If you hit your head on the concrete, you don't necessarily know at the time that you may have broken an artery in your head, and you can get a subdural hematoma, which will show up later. Now, that can be fatal, or sometimes you have to have a neurosurgeon go in and open it up.
Dr. Dave Davis of Piedmont Hospital says a broken limb could also cost you time and money. But that hasn't stopped millions of people from taking their chances with the Crate Challenge. So far, more than 40 million people have hashtagged Crate Challenge videos on TikTok. Other attempts have been more dangerous than this. Another recent video appears to show a local man from Atlanta attempting to make the climb this weekend. But before he could reach the top, bullets are heard blasting in the background. It's unclear whether or not he was shot.
It's not worth the risk.
Signs posted on crates in Kroger and College Park appear to show they were on sale for just $1. However, Kroger says it's only the jugs of water inside the crates that are for purchase, not the crates themselves.
You can't touch it.
But somehow, crates are still stacking up everywhere for the Milk Crate Challenge.
It's maybe fun to take a chance like that, but what can happen is very serious.
Now, this is not the only dangerous trend that we have seen circulated online. You may remember back in 2018, the Tide Pod Challenge, where many kids experienced getting poisoned after trying to eat the detergent pods. Reporting from Gresham Park in DeKalb County, I'm Tori Cooper, CBS 46 News.
Context of white supremacy, hearing about Atlanta, got me befuddled for a moment. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 28th, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I was not going to play any more content, get to the callers, share a few words. So many things happened this week to discuss. However, I had already completed the news segments, got everything ready to roll so we could do the broadcast. I'm sitting about an hour or so, maybe 2 hours before the program went live. And I checked NPR just to see, you know, they have afternoon news that comes out, see if anything new or interesting came out. Now, again, that moron, he says, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. In addition to all of that, over the past, I think, caller in Florida. Some of the other CAS listeners have been paying attention to what they're calling unruly passenger behavior during flights over the past 4 or 5 months or so this year. White people being unruly. All of that converged in this segment that just NPR published literally minutes before we went live.
More than 1,000 Americans are dying of COVID-19 every day, and yet many people are still fighting mandates put in place to keep them safe. That's especially true on airlines, where some people are literally fighting. The Federal Aviation Administration has reported more than 3,900 incidents involving unruly passengers this year alone. That's a huge jump from prior years, even taking into account the recent slowdown in air travel. And more than half of those incidents are related to wearing masks. And a new survey by the association that represents flight attendants found that 85% of flight attendants say they've had to deal with disruptive passengers in 2021, and nearly 1 in 5 even had physical altercations with disorderly flyers. We wanted to hear more about this from the perspective of some of the people forced to deal with it, so we called Sarah Nelson. She is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, and she is with us now. Sarah Nelson, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Now, I'm assuming that many people listening to our conversation will have seen, you know, television stories or videos of some of these encounters. But I'm wondering what you've been hearing from flight attendants. Just how often are they dealing with this? And if there are any specific incidents that stood out to you?
We've never seen this number of incidents in the skies. And the difference here is that we are trained in de-escalation tactics. We're trained in dealing with unruly passengers. But this is not a one-off incident. Every day when flight attendants are putting on their uniforms, they're thinking, is this the day I'm going to get punched in the face? It's just that commonplace. And what they're telling us is that this is a result of full aircraft and people being told that masks are a political issue rather than a public health necessity. We've got more people who are drinking and bringing those drinks on board, which you're not allowed to do under federal regulations. After the last year and a half that we have had and the conflicting messaging coming from leadership just all around this pandemic and the stress that people have been under over the last year. And we often are at the tip of the spear of anything that's happening socially or politically in the country. And what we're seeing is that, you know, people are upset. They're at their wit's end. People have been told that we're at odds with each other and been told that flight attendants and the work that we're doing and what we have to enforce on board is interfering with their rights. But I don't think we're alone. I think this is happening in grocery stores and post offices and
sporting events and other places where people.
Exactly.
So let me ask you about this. You mentioned masks. More than half, this is according to the FAA data, more than half of these incidents are mask related. And it seems to start there. But you also mentioned the role of alcohol. The FAA has called for airports to discourage the sale of to-go alcoholic beverages. Do those two things go together? I mean, what's the match and like what's the fuel?
Alcohol is absolutely a contributor. So I don't want to say that alcohol is always the cause for these events, but alcohol is the biggest contributor to them. So let's face it, people are coming back to the airports and they haven't flown in a while. They don't really remember or know that up in the air at pressurized at 8,000 feet, that alcohol can affect you more. And when there's delays in the airport, what are people doing? They're sitting there drinking. So everything that we can do to minimize the alcohol that's being consumed before people get on the plane or on the plane is just going to help to bring these incidents down. And the more that we can lift up the helpers and make this a really socially unacceptable thing to do on a plane, the better off we're going to be. We do not have our regular passengers to just sort of show people how the program works. So that makes it very difficult. So passengers can be very helpful in identifying that for us and being good witnesses.
Well, I'm not sure if you really want to go there, but if you do, I want to hear it. Is in part what you're saying that the flying public is different, that a lot of the customary business passengers or people flying who are frequent flyers or are not flying, and that perhaps a lot of the people who are on planes right now are not accustomed to flying and maybe have not absorbed some of the norms? Is that in part what you're saying?
Well, whenever someone doesn't really know the procedures, I mean, don't forget, this is a really different space. You can't bring your gun or your knife into our workplace. You have to practically undress to show that you're not a security threat. You have to follow certain rules and regulations. And if you don't really know the program and you don't know what to expect, that can also lead to a lot of anxiety. So we're oftentimes just answering questions of people. It's not as though the people who are flying are, you know, worse people than we would normally have on the planes. But when
I'm not saying that.
No, worse.
I'm not going to make a value judgment, but what I am saying is, are you seeing that in part that people who are flying are not people who are accustomed to flying? Is that in part what's contributing to this?
Absolutely. And I want to be really clear. Some people have misunderstood when we have said that and said that, you know, it's people who don't know how to behave. That's not what we're saying at all. Thank you for making it so clear. Because this is really about the fact that people just don't know what to expect. And before coronavirus, at least 30% of the people were regular flyers. And what happens in those instances is the rest of the crowd is sort of watching what other people are doing. It's a little bit of follow the leader. It's a lot more taxing when people just don't know the program and don't know what to expect. And we have to keep reminding people about what to do.
Interesting. So before we let you go, back in January, FAA Administrator Steve Dixon announced a zero-tolerance policy against disruptive behavior while onboard commercial flights, but stopping the agency from issuing warnings and instead moving forward toward enforcement. But are there other things that you think the FAA should do? Are there other changes that you think should be made?
Well, look, FAA needs more funding for more investigators and to move more quickly through these reports. That is for sure. But they have a significant number of reports that the DOJ can pick up and use to criminally prosecute. We have, under the statute, the ability to fine people up to $35,000 per incident, and that's what the FAA has been doing, but also to criminally prosecute, and people can face up to 20 years in prison. With all of the drinking out there, you know, it's a real metaphor. We need some sobering up here. And what we find is that when the consequences are very clear and when people are going to jail, that serves as a real deterrent and people start to sober up really fast. So there needs to be better coordination across the government to address this issue and to make it very clear to the public what the rules are, why they're in place, and what the consequences are if you don't do your part.
That was Sarah Nelson, International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. Sarah Nelson, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Wow, that was disgusting and interesting at the same time, almost equally. Number one, before I even share a thought or three, they have a thing called a no-fly list. This, I think, is a product of the 9/11 era. Sometimes they didn't even explain why you have been placed on the no-fly list. Lots of controversy and question about this. We're in the middle, like nearly 2 years long into a global health crisis. Why not at this point? Hey, you have one time to get on a flight. Any reason. I'm anti-vax. I'm anti-mask. You don't boss me. One time to get on a flight for any reason. We have to land the plane. We have to duct tape you, any of that. No fly list. We are prosecuting to the fullest extent of the law. 13, whatever, no fly list. Why not that? Why do you even have a no fly list if it's not for folks who are endangering those on the flight, which is what this behavior clearly is. Anyway, we need some sobering up. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I will say I found that piece repulsive because the repulsive elements of the report, I'm sure individuals classified as white, especially the more intelligent folks at the FAA and the airline industry, I'm sure they've known for a long time about the impact of alcohol and when you fly, and maybe a greater impact because of the pressure and the altitude. I'm sure that's not something that they just found out since the beginning of the Rona. So you could have adjusted that policy a long time ago. And it just, to me, it sounded like ignorance. Like, are you telling me Maxwell Berry, that is the individual classified as white, that they had to duct tape to the chair and land the plane? Now, it did seem he was intoxicated when he was assaulting and groping flight attendants. Are you telling me this was his first time being on a plane? Or are you telling me that he forgot the proper rules of conduct and behavior on an airline over the past month and a half? That the terrorism of white people, I mean, really, call these folks terrorists. How about that? Maxwell Berry, terrorist. You get on that, you assault airline attendants, groping airline attendants. You have to be duct taped and we land the plane. Why is that not a terrorist? Prosecute to the fullest extent of the law. But this is not ignorance. This is not they forgot protocol and procedure. It's been white defiance. In fact, not even calling out that these are white people. When they said that these are not the typical people that fly in the normal business class and what have you, again, Maxwell Berry didn't exactly strike me as someone who had never been on a plane before. And they've had so many reports. They had a report of an entire class of mostly white students in North Carolina had to land the plane, same disruptive behavior. They said this was an annual trip. They had a class of girls, so-called Jewish, 13-year-olds, same thing, had to land the plane. I don't think this was their first time being on a plane. And I suspect at 13, alcohol probably wouldn't be to blame, although I could be wrong. White defiance, man, not ignorance. And lots of guns have been reported at the airport of late. Now, I don't know if, again, that's people are ignorant about the rules of flying, although that's been a rule for a long time, like decades, no guns at the airport. So you would have to be like, I don't know, you haven't flown in 40 years or something? You just forgot? I reckon they have rules. I think when you go to purchase your plane, they tell you the type of material that you cannot bring on a plane. Guns is high on that list, or are high on that list. Next, few things, then we'll get to the callers. News. Let's see. They have the report going on in the continent saying that they're being ravaged by the Delta variant. Just for me, that was enough. And especially when they started going through the numbers, and they were talking about the entire continent, not just one country. Unvaccinated equals non-white. Perhaps unvaccinated equals individuals classified as black specifically. Let's see, when they spoke with the coach out in Oregon, where they say they got the rule together, no Black Lives Matter, no gay pride, LGBTQ flags, neither one. For the workplace, which is pretty much school, I generally say, hey, no politics, no, you're not wearing buttons and all that other, you know, paraphernalia in the work environment. For schools, white people, they have a lot of authority over what's going to happen in their public schools. So it doesn't surprise me personally. The Black Lives Matter flag or shirt or poster or whatever, that would not provide me any comfort in a system of white supremacy. Just the fact that that's included with the LGBTQ flag. Again, the conflation, got to discuss those two topics together as though they are the same. I don't know if that provides comfort for someone who classifies as all that. They would have to explain the mechanics of all of that. I thought it was, I'll save that, save that. When they talked about Sturgis, man, Neely Fuller Jr., they will go up to Sturgis for a little while. No black people. They got to come back down quickly. They said in the report a 450% increase in COVID-19 cases as a result of the Sturgis rally with all, I mean, they could have said white people exclusively nearly with this event. Planes, too, you got lots of white people misbehaving in this sort of thing. They said in that report they tried to stop it last year, had no success. The bikers were going to come anyway. So this year, everyone has just given up. I lived in Atlanta. I never participated in Freaknik, but I know of it as a former Atlanta resident. I know some of the history of the town, good days and bad. We've had a retired firefighter in Florida. I think they have Black Biker Weekend and what have you, and other events at beaches and different locations that are exclusively for black people. Heck, I even remember in North Carolina, within the last 6 to 7 years, they had a black basketball tournament with, I think, historically black colleges and universities. And there ended up being some sort of problem at the hotel where they were or placing some sort of surcharge on black patrons who were there for this black basketball tournament. They don't, white people, they don't just say, oh my goodness, the Negroes are coming. Pricknick, what are we going to do? Yeah, we told them and we don't want them here and there's too much noise and all the rest. We give up. We just give up. Let Freaknik reign. That's not the position that they took in Atlanta. That's not the position that they took for Black Biker Weekend in Miami and other events that they have for black people. That's not this. We just give up. You know, it's, what can we done? Just go out of town for that week. Nah, we individuals classified as white, they know how to stop misbehavior, gatherings, group events. They know how to put a stop to all of that. Apparently, they didn't want to. 450% increase in cases, so they say. Have it again next year, I'm sure. They did the report on words. So much with words this week. They did the report on breakthrough infections. That is such an important term. I think it's important just because a term like breakthrough, it suggests that this is unusual, that there's something odd about someone being vaccinated and yet contracting the virus. That obviously, I mean, super obviously cannot be the case, or they wouldn't be talking about booster shots. That is recent. Even the reports that we heard where it was booster shots in the context of this is preventative. This is the metaphor getting out in front of the curve. The context that I have heard is the word waning. The protection wanes. So you have to get a booster shot. That's what I've heard. Again, I'm not a medical professional, but and they've had a number of reports. The CDC, when I say they, this was in the Seattle Times where they talked about a super spreader event similar to what they talked about in Sturgis, where about 75% of the population, and that's the number that they gave, 3/4 of the people were fully vaccinated who contracted COVID-19 and ended up spreading it. And they had lots of information. I won't read the whole report now, but that term breakthrough, in my view, conveys way more certainty than should be allowed for this moment, for the evidence that is available, not a medical professional. In the same report, they said the absence of data about so-called breakthrough infections leaves us in the dark. Again, the black people, the dark people, ignorant, missing information. Next, when they were in the segment talking about the fights in schools over masks and all the rest of it, and they said it was one of the educators, she said when she sees someone come in and they have a flag, now she thinks, ooh, flagpole, that could be a weapon. I immediately thought Ted Landsmark. That was the Time Photo of the Year, I believe, for 1976, 1977, sometime in there, where he was actually speared with the so-called American flag, red, white, and blue, over what school, same thing, same area of people activity, where they were doing so-called busing, and we don't want the Negro students here in Boston, but yes, flags, flagpoles can be used as a weapon. Let's see, they had the same segment where they were talking about the flags in Portland, Oregon, or it might not have even been Portland, Oregon specifically, where they talked about the flags and we're not going to have, that's the new rule, can't have all that stuff here. You know, we're going to stay focused on our learning. And they said that seeing, or they got one of the students and he said that seeing that LGBTQ flag gave him a sense of comfort, security. Again, I would have to get the mechanics of that explained. But he said that taking that flag down, he feels like he's walking through a war zone. Said what he said. My view, and I'll just relate mine to the Black Lives Matter flag. If that flag being taken down makes you think that you're in a war zone, racism, white supremacy, keep the flag down because you are. You do not want to be confused or forget that just because that flag is up, which can be the refinement. They can do a lot of things and present paraphernalia and make it seem like, oh, yes, they are addressing racism and all the rest of it. Don't be fooled. You are in a war zone. Sometimes the people with the Black Lives Matter signs are just the most refined, dangerous race soldiers. Be aware. Let's see. They said in that same segment in Oregon, they said they were talking. They had some of the black parents talking about how their children had been treated. And they said, hey, these children, they know how society treats them. Said that's not being specific. I don't even know what you mean when you say society. Do you mean how white people mistreat them, practice racism, white supremacy against them? Got it. We are trained not to be explicit, clear about the problem. The metaphors, there were so many of them. When they talked to Dr. Collins, who I suspect is a white person, they were talking to him about the FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine. And he, or the NPR reporter said that many have already crossed that bridge, meaning the vaccine, and they didn't fall on their face. They didn't die, all the rest of it. Apparently, they're going to have to get a booster shot. So maybe if I'm using their metaphor, they have not crossed the bridge. If you got to get a booster shot, maybe you're still on it. Metaphors. And then they said that some were still on the fence, meaning the unvaccinated non-white people. And I said, man, that's a really imprecise, sloppy metaphor for this context. In my view, there's so many reasons. You got white people who they say it's 5G. That doesn't seem on the fence. You got some people, white people, who said you're not. This is tyranny, government oppression. You got some people who got medical concerns. It's lots of different reasons. So I don't sloppy, imprecise to say on the fence. Many of these people, it's, and even on the fence, suggest that they haven't come to a conclusion or they're still thinking. Many people, it seems, have come to a conclusion that they have serious enough concerns about this that they are not going to take it, regardless of the FDA approval or anything else. Nothing is going to change their mind for a variety of reasons. See, I didn't even mention Tuskegee. Let's see. Biddy Mason, first segment that we played, I included a comic horn honk when they said that Biddy Mason Park is right next to the parking lot that is so common and tacky in the system of white supremacy, where they'll have like a monument to some black person or to slaves or whatever it is, and it'll be underneath the parking garage or next to the sewage treatment plant. That type of thing is so in James Lowen's book. I think he passed away within the past couple of days. Sundown Towns. We read his book in the book club, but I thought that was so tacky. But I did put the comedy honk there just to kind of highlight the tackiness of it all. They included in that segment that Biddy Mason, black female victim of racism, that her skills as a midwife, very important, allowed her to overcome the color line. I have no idea what the color line is, nor do I know how having some knowledge of midwifery would help you escape white supremacy racism. I seriously, seriously doubt it. I have seen many, many black people, non-white people, who have been very helpful and beneficial to white people, some for like years and years and years. It did not help them overcome the so-called color line. We shall overcome. Isn't it like the anniversary, so-called, of the March on Washington? We still waiting to overcome, cross the bridge. Milk crate challenge. And then we can get to the callers. Man, what is your life supposed to be about? Racist man, racist woman, racist child, generally tell us, victims, non-white people all over the world. I strongly suspect some people classified as white are the genesis for this milk crate challenge. Number one, I said just for myself personally, the challenge would be, Gus T, do you think you can amass 50 milk crates in 48 hours? We'll give you a week. That would be the challenge right there. That would take me some time and energy to even get my hands on milk crates, because they don't even sell those generally. Anywho, I think it's very easy for some racists, and particularly with everything that's happening right now. Every other day, you got the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick in Texas that got global attention. It's niggers, you know. The problem right now is unvaccinated people, and that's niggers. That lots of people saying that directly, indirectly, to make that computation, white genetic annihilation, I keep saying that, fueling so much of the behavior that we're seeing right now, put that together and then just keep showing images of black people on milk crates. And, oh, hurting themselves, and that just that in and of itself, not just black people doing something non-constructive and silly, but self-injurious, making entertainment out of harming themselves. Keep flashing that in this environment. And further motivate and encourage, like, this is what we're leaving the planet to. This is what we're talking about doing benefits for. Then this is what we got to have critical race theory in the school for, and Black Lives Matter, for them to go out and steal milk crates and kill each other. Tie this to the city of Atlanta, the beloved Negro town, ATL. Tie this there. Oh, yes. Many of these have happened right here. Piedmont Park. Yes, indeed. I think they said Gresham Park and whatever. Pick your Atlanta park. They'll have it right out in the middle of Peachtree. Lenox Mall at some point. And I'm sure there are some black people, because all it would take is to get some white people to say, yeah, let's do this. Show the black people just being total buffoons and everything. 2021 minstrel show, right? And then go grab some black person, entertainer, or what have you. Hey, go, you know, tweet this. Put this on your Instagram. Say something about it. Say something funny or what have you. And just, you know, maybe two or three tweets about it. That might be enough. And then, boom. Get folks imitating and all the rest of it. I can only say many, many victims of white supremacy when you're confused. It's the reason Mr. Fuller has that at the beginning of the book. When you're confused about white supremacy, racism, what it is and how it works, you can end up doing the milk challenge. I don't think he says that specifically, but oh yeah, when you are confused about what your life is supposed to be about, what you're supposed to be doing with your time and energy, you could end up on top of some crates. Man, oh man, safety. Been saying that so much. Safety. That is the word of the year. Safety. Having people have become an international spectacle. People watching black people, again, engage in recreational fun activity. That is super unsafe, dangerous. The FDA, in fact, contrast. So the FDA this week, two times in the news headlines, they were in the news for their approval of Pfizer's vaccine. The FDA commented on the milk crate challenge as well. How does that impact racist brain computer, white genetic annihilation, the niggers on the milk crates? Ugh. The number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. You can take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions. That would be grand. Make sure everybody has at least one opportunity to share. Let's see, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be appreciated. Just make sure we don't have to speak over a lot of unnecessary background noise. Much obliged, and no metaphors. I just gave a lengthy list that we heard from the audio segments just this week. Race soldiers will you break through. They will use metaphors like that color line to cause confusion, deception, victims. We are still learning. Let's try as best we can to be precise, specific, exact with our words. They are so important. Star 61 if you have commentary. Let's see. First few folks dialed in. Hands up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Hello. Glad you heard.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Hotep. Health and wellness to everyone. You know, it's really sad what's going on right now. Tomorrow, I'm not in Louisiana. Tomorrow's supposed to be a hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast, and Yeah, it's like it's going to be hitting Monday. Like, so actually coming like a year to the day of Hurricane Katrina, you know, in the number of years, like a day after and stuff. And talking to some friends that are still in New Orleans, there was nothing they could do. There was nothing they could do to just be able to leave, because they didn't have the money or they don't have any place to go. I have people that I know in the Midwest, so I'm gone, but they're there. They're stuck. Meanwhile, I saw the crate challenge sometime during the week, and I think non-white people, especially black people, don't ever ponder who came up with this challenge. You know, kind of, that's the question I had when they came up with the Tide Pod challenge and the douse yourself with lighter fluid challenge and try to get frostbite challenge. And, you know, I'm sure there's going to be some other challenge that is going to escalate in self-harm. And nobody ever says who started, what's the first, where did this come from? And like you said, Gus, where are these crates coming from? Normally you don't even have crates. You don't even see crates outside of the back of the store, you know, ready for discard or reuse. But then we're on display for being childlike. So this is what the white supremacists are probably also going to say to their defense. How can childlike people know what's good for their health? If you knew what was good for your health, you wouldn't climb a pyramid of loose crates. You know what I'm saying? So how in the world can you tell me that you don't trust what's in a vaccine? You can't possibly know what's good for your health. And winter's coming. So you mean to tell me, you know, it's something me and my friend been talking about geological changes. So winter's coming for a lot of places. This is what you're doing, like in the fall. You're not trying to get your stuff together, make sure you got backup generators or extra food or something. Just what? I try to stay patient with other black people as much as possible. And it's really, it's just so frustrating because they're victims of racism. And what ends up happening, I get frustrated with black people and then I just get angry with white people because of my frustration. And I know Dr. Francis said that's cheap, but I can't help it sometimes. Because this is all by design. And then, you know, I'm thinking about my own personal problem that I'm going through with my son, because these people they've made cannabis so accessible. And, you know, and me being a victim a few years ago, not knowing how white people were, you know what I'm saying, just the system, I've accidentally made my child white identified. And I tried to correct it the past 3 years, but it hasn't really worked because that life is more gratifying to him. He sees more reward on that side, but he's not understanding that's because these people are white and they're of certain white families, and that's why they have what they have. But he's just going to have to see, like my grandmother said, time and living on. But this is just, I pray we do better. And I will mute my line for now. Thank you, everyone.
Improvement in behavior. All of us looking for improvement in our behavior, improvement in our understanding of racism, white supremacy, and hopefully all else will follow. Can I say it one more time? That idiot, he says sobriety would be best. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing talked about that. Get young black children, boys and girls, get them on cannabis, thinking it's cool, medicinal even. Hey, this is wonderful. This is a part of health and wellness. She talked about that in detail. I was going back 2013. I went back to listen to that program today, in fact. 2013, she was with us in July. It was 1 week after the trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. Florida again. But our thoughts, health, wishing health and wellness to your offspring. That is both the cannabis and the white identification that's come up so many times this week. People talking about different victims, talking about navigating being around white identified victims or having white identified people in their family and, you know, what to do with that and how to help them. And plant seeds, that is the metaphor. Try to have constructive information that you've offered. So sometimes experience is the best teacher. And then, mom was trying to tell me about this. Yes, yes. The questions I love. Who came up with this? Why am I doing this? I'll just say before we nab some of the other folks who dialed in, the milk crate challenge. So the crates, again, these crates are not for sale. These crates, generally, you would have to steal them, or I guess maybe you could find a deal on Craigslist or something like that, eBay from time to time. But generally, these crates are not for sale. It would be a task in and of itself to get that many of them, but they're arranged in a pyramid as people walk up them, right? So we have the Delta variant. The symbol for Delta is a triangle pyramid. And then Delta is actually the only airline that has a $200 surcharge if you are not vaccinated. And so Delta, and then the pyramid challenge that is also just happens to be in the symbol of a pyramid, Delta. May mean something, may mean nothing at all, but system of white supremacy. I tend to think every, especially things that they focused a lot of attention on, tend to mean something. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up.
Greetings,
retired firefighter in Florida. His voice was in our sound clip on the young suicides, youth suicides with black children.
Yes, sir. Speaking of children, today was the first day of the newest session of the DCS mentoring program. We just went through introductory issues and procedures such as passing out equipment, pencils, pens, backpacks, with some of the different things such as an oath, a call and respond. I wouldn't call it a poem, but a chant that the program has created, that they basically something, you know, from an aspiring point of view to have with them, basically telling them about what to expect out of the program, rules of engagement. In that light, creating a foundation of codification, what to say to another person, what not to say, what to do, what not to do, you know, such as fighting and whatnot, that sort of thing, and introduce to some of them. I would say a vast amount of them, it would be introducing them to what is your place as a member of a group that's called a family that is probably under the global system of racist white supremacy, would best be described as a care group. What is your position? What should you be doing? The only person that shouldn't be doing anything is a newborn or a very young infant. Certainly everybody that was in that library about 10 hours ago is capable of actively participating in the progress of that group, of doing something, if it is nothing but cleaning up your room, practicing hygiene for yourself, such as taking a bath, brushing your teeth. These are the things that are what I understand as a foundation of a foundation with these non-white male children who soon would be treated, if not already, treated as adults when it comes to the races. And it was, you know, they went through quite fluidly. One thing that was very impressive, and I'm still saying to myself, why didn't I think of this? Because you have brought up about the food arrangement and whatnot. And what Mr. Clark imposed was choices. He picked up more within the eating process of the program to give more healthy choices. And I can see it right before my eyes working. He gave more healthy choices. And when they got to the fruit section, matter of fact, he said that, you can get one sweet thing, but the next time around, you're going to have to choose a healthy choice. But they were deciding amongst themselves to have the take the healthy choice. There is about, I would say the numbers was today about 20 to 21. And we just about ran out of all of the fruit. And we had a lot of fruit, pineapple, grapes, the two different types of grapes, cantaloupe, watermelon, those are all I can think about. But they literally just ate up all of that. You know, so from that standpoint, we are progressing. We're progressing with the food situation by making more healthier choices. Healthier choices. They're making healthier choices. So I like to see that, you know, it's moving right along, moving in a correct direction, and only seeking to become better and better. And that's where I will end for right now. Thank you.
The metaphor, music to my ears. So constructive. He talk about foundation. Doesn't get more foundational than what you eat, especially for young folks. So bravo, you and Mr. Clark, any other folks who were involved with the activities that took place earlier today. That is awesome. And I'm not surprised at all about the fruits. It is summertime in Florida. I mean, everything is full bloom and ripe, so you can have a regular cornucopia of delicious everything he just named. All of that. I mean, hey, how could you not? We're in Florida. That's what it's supposed to be about. Sit, throw a orange in there just for giggles and whoopee, you know, do it up. All kinds of fresh. And who wouldn't love fresh, ripe, juicy fruit in the summertime? Of course. Yes. Delicious, hydrating, nourishing. Bravo. Love it.
And the principal spent most of his day with us of the high school that we meet at. Spent most of his day with us. Yeah, that was very good.
Love it, love it, love it. Bravo again, Mr. Clark, retired firefighter. Any other folks who, I guess older folks who were involved with the young people. Before I nab some of the other callers, I'll give out the number again, 720 716-7300, the code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Irie, she said, I'm not in Louisiana right now. The hurricane, it's been so much going on and just worst year ever continues. But I did see the news reports about the hurricane in Louisiana, and I'm just reading the reports, so we'll have this included as well. This is from WAFB9. Hurricane Ida will be strongest storm to hit Louisiana since 1850s. Governor warns. I had to look at that twice, like 1850s, for real? Like, wow. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards gave a dire warning for state residents to take all necessary precautions and prepare for the potentially catastrophic impacts of Hurricane Ida during a news conference around 2 p.m. Saturday, August 28th. Edwards said Hurricane Ida, which is forecast to intensify to a powerful Category 4 storm before making landfall along the state's southeastern coast Sunday, August 29, will be the strongest storm to hit anywhere in the state since the 1850s. Said it again. The governor said intense wind gusts of up to 110 miles per hour could be felt all throughout southeast Louisiana, as far north as the Mississippi state line. Jeez. And as far west as Lafayette. He acknowledged Hurricane Ida will be making landfall on the 16th. And that is not an anniversary. Like I said, anniversary for the March on Washington. Maybe that is the correct word. This is not an anniversary. It would just be 16 years since, and it's not even, it's incorrect all the way through. Words are important. It would be 16 years since Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure. That was a huge part. Some would say the problem for what took place was not Hurricane Katrina. It was the levee failure. Army Corps of Engineers. But Katrina, after the flood, book club again. We read that and we read it. It was the so-called 10-year anniversary. Totally incorrect use of words. Like over 1,000 black people could have died instantly in that event with everything that took place over that weekend and police shootings and white terrorism and all the rest of it. We did some of our signature work on Hurricane Katrina. So absolutely, that is a huge void or something to neglect on my part in terms of not including that. So much obliged. Glad we got Irie to include that. And any of the cows listeners in that area, hope you are safe. She said that she knew friends who were still in Louisiana who didn't have the ability to vacate. How can that be? Like, we went through this already. Everybody had a memory and blame Ray Nagin for everything and put him in jail for stealing rocks. Like, no, it would have to be like, hey, I don't care what your circumstances are. This is the bus. We already got this set up for people who don't have resources or whatever. You are out of here. We are not doing any of that from Hurricane Katrina. We are evacuating. We're getting folks to high ground. No metaphor. High ground. Safety. That would be number one priority. How can that be? Pull Ray Nagin out and blame him again. Say it was his fault this time around too. Man, I've never lived in Louisiana, but I have been in Louisiana when they were under the threat of a hurricane. Yikes, that is scary times. Safety to everyone there. Much obliged again to Irie for compensating for my negligence. So important what's going down in Louisiana right now. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments here to share, line should be open. Proceed. See if folks are getting their notes together, thoughts together, while folks are pondering or thinking, you can support, invest in the context of white supremacy, listener supported, Counter Racist Radio, the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Also on Cash App, the address cash.app/$thecows. Huge thanks to the numerous investors all over the planet who have kept the cows on the air for 12 plus years. Hopefully the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. One of the lamest summers ever continues. I'm all like excited and thinking, oh man, I got all my goodies, my Amazon wish list. Thinking I'm going to use the Hob Locker, right? Because there's Whole Foods super close to where I live at. And since Amazon owns Whole Foods, they have the Amazon lockers there so you can shop, get your packages all at the same time, boom, boom, boom. And so I put in the Hub Locker. I'd never tried it before, but I've seen these for so long. Like, oh, that's so interesting. You could do the little pickup at the thing. So I'm thinking I can try it, get my packages. I'm so excited because the computer piece that I needed, external USB hard drive, I'm thinking I'm going to get it. So I'm all excited, waiting, thinking it's going to be there. And then turns out, no, you cannot get your wish list items delivered to the Hub Locker. I didn't find this out until they had already shipped everything. And like, oh, nope, nope, nope, nope. Worst summer ever continues. So I'm switching my address again on my wish list. So once I update it again, we'll try again. But man, that is, you think you get something? I couldn't even, what do they call it, the term they use, Indian giving? I couldn't even apply that when it's, oh man, you might have something from your wish. No, you do not have anything from your wish list. 2021 just keeps rolling. Let's see. Before I check for other folks, there was one segment I was going to include. A listener emailed this to me. It was Dr. Christina Parks, non-white female. I think she might be a black female, classified as such. She was speaking before the House, and they were talking about the vaccine, possible mandates and what have you for different employees. As a medical professional doctor, she was saying, hey, people, just because you're vaccinated does not mean that you cannot contract and or spread COVID-19. And she was saying that just because you're vaccinated does not mean that you're going to be any safer or less likely to spread the virus, which is what, you know, I've been saying. I'd seen reports that were saying, in fact, she cited the same report or the same event. Because there's a CDC report about all of this where there was a super spreader event, so-called, in the New England area where 75% of the people were vaccinated and they were still spreading and contracting the virus. But I was going to play it, but I looked at the date. This happened last week, the compensatory call, and I generally only play reports that took place over the last 7 days. And it kind of veered away from workplace racism into just kind of thoughts on the vaccine, and I think Tuskegee even came up. So I did not play it. I thought I was, but I did not play it. But I would encourage folks to check it out. And even some of the responses, it seemed like there was some name calling of Dr. Christina Parks, victim of racism, white supremacy. And she did mention racism when she was giving her presentation to the House. But that was not like the crux or the main point that she was trying to make. The main point was just, we have been misled about how effective this vaccine is. Booster shots. Why do you need a booster shot if it's so effective? Let's see. Other folks who dialed in. I am not a medical professional. Make sure I repeat that. Other folks, we missed you totally. You have commentary to share. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the, I think it was the segment where they were talking about, I think, the suicide rate or the level of the suicide rate with black youth. And I found it interesting how the guy who was asking the questions, he was trying to find out what is the reasoning behind the suicide occurring. And I noticed how they played the segment with, I think that was a black mother, attempted parent, saying how she noticed some of the signs that I guess was brought up to her. But she was saying something about, oh, it was so expensive to do the studying or whatever. And I just thought that that was odd to me. Like, it didn't really make any sense. You know, I'm still learning and everything. But with all of the studies they do on other type of things, why not have the financial resources or the budget or whatnot to do a study on that? And but I guess they were also saying that the suicide rates were going down, I guess, for the white teenagers or the youth. I thought that was interesting. And the segment where I think where the 6-year-old, they said the 6-year-old was crying, and the parents, I think, were trying to get away from the, I don't know if I can say the lunatic, that might be a metaphor, or the terroristic behavior of that female. I don't know if that was a white person or not, but I think the audio described that she pulled out a machete type of blade or sword or something. That is just very dangerous, that kind of a situation. And I noticed that they, at the end of the segment, mentioned, well, maybe she'll be able to get her some help or something like that. I don't think they described that for black people who end up getting arrested. There was a segment on a news report here locally of this black male, an elderly black male, who in one of the local hospitals in town, he went through a long, months-long sickness with COVID-19. And there was a news report on it last year. He was able to fortunately make it through. And a couple of days ago, there was an update of this person, a black male, and they gave him a job, right? So it's a whole bunch of white people surrounding them, taking pictures and everything. I think it was theatrics behind it. The reason I say that is with this segment that I saw, they gave the person some kind of a job to be a greeter of some type, but the racism and the name calling, like, his name tag said The Amazing Henry, and I just thought that didn't sound right to me. Like, and they were interviewing the doctors and everything, the nurses, they just have their names, but they had The Amazing, in quotes, Henry, The Amazing Henry. And I just think that they're not looking at him as a human being with that title. Like, I think that's mistreatment. That's racism with that title on his name tag. So I guess they gave him a job, which is constructive, but I still think racism is being practiced with that. And other than that, that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. When they use that phrasing, I generally hear that associated with something like the circus or some kind of like performing act, like the amazing Malini. You know, he's going to come out and do some magic tricks, or, you know, the amazing Bojangles, you know, something of that nature, a performance, you know, some sort of like entertainment. That's what I would expect. Not if we're in a job, like you said, nobody else has that on their name tag. It's just, you know, Lisa, Jim, Rhonda, the amazing Henry. Like, doesn't get any better than tacky. Incidentally, the situation now, they did say the family was from Tacoma. That was like local. When I say local, like news in the region where I live, local. So that was local news for me. But this incident happened in Portland, which is also local, really. But this happened. So that was twofer. And they had, I think, the Proud Boys and some of the other white people had some clash down in Portland as well this week. Lots of things happening. It's about, well, we could drive to Portland. It's very close, in like 3 hours. You can drive from Seattle to Portland. Easy. 3 hours. But that incident, the attacker, Elizabeth Zerker Wood, 37, from this video, she looks like, definitely, she would be classified as white. Blue eyes, definitely, she'd be classified as white. And they do have pictures of the machete that she allegedly threatened to, you know, kill this family while she was going to kidnap this black child. In addition to the machete, they have a image of what... I'm not a barbarian, okay? So I'm not a weapons expert. I don't know what this is. But if you can think of like knights in like the medieval, I don't know if people watch Game of Thrones. I didn't, but like the weaponry that you would see there. So like the axe type weapon that's like really large, and it's got the spike on the opposite end of the axe, and it's even pointed at the end, like. you're gonna be like on a horse and you're wearing a coat of armor and you're gonna go joust someone and then pull out your axe and finish that. That's what it looks like. Not even sure where to begin to describe. Like, that's what I mean about this is the state in terms of people behaving. That's what it's been all year long. This side of behavior on planes, just out and about. Floyd Ray Roseberry, they probably, people don't even remember that. White man goes to D.C., the nation's capital, and threatens to blow up the Library of Congress. And in within days, milk crate challenge. And then they come back and say, yeah, I just didn't have my brain medication, Your Honor. I just wasn't able to think clearly. Oh, are you sure, Mr. Roseberry? I don't know if you're going to be able to understand these proceedings. Another terrorist. White terrorist, be specific. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Racial fear, that's one of the terms I picked up doing the broadcast over the years. Excellent. Just for the times when the amazing Henry, white people are just practicing racism, white supremacy for entertainment. So they'll make a little performance out of it all. Sometimes they'll involve the victims of racism, racial theater. Other folks, thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, questions they want to make sure they get in. Caller at 1159, 1159 should be with us as well.
Greetings, guys. Greetings, callers, listeners. The segment with the white female attempting to kidnap a child, from watching a lot of crime videos and just videos involving incorrect things that happen on planet Earth involving white people, I've detected that is also a racist behavior pattern that white females, white people participate in. And I recently was told by a person I went to high school with that she got COVID from her son. And I suspect he probably got it from the school, but I don't know. I don't know for sure.
Was she vaccinated? Do you know?
I don't. I have no clue if she's vaccinated. I will ask. Yeah. Oh, and the crate challenge. Very tragic that we can get non-white people to participate in the crate challenge, ice water, ice bucket challenge, but not the counter racism challenge or read the book challenge or think seriously challenge. It's really infuriating to just see the position and just how disastrous. I really appreciate you playing that clip because one of my associates posted that term on Facebook recently, that disasters, and that is truly what is happening. Something that we would perceive to be utterly useless. I haven't seen a milk crate since the 90s. But here they are, and every social media, in every word you can see videos, you see people, so-called people of color, following and climbing up these cartons. And I do appreciate your decoding of the pyramids and the triangle stuff. I don't know if it means anything, but I found something that I picked up on. And I'm aware of how they hide everything in symbols and numbers and all this convoluted just stuff that comes from the system of racism, white supremacy. Very tragic, very should be expected for sure. I'll be my line.
Tragic indeed, sir. Tragic indeed. These Zapsters, one of my all-time favorites from Neely Fuller Jr.'s many, many, many, many, many, many visits to the context of white supremacy. He and Dr. Welsing. I think that was 2012. Memory might not, be totally accurate, but I think that was 2012. When we got the Zapsters, painfully relevant still almost a decade later. But again, everything comes back to page one of any of Mr. Fuller's written works. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works, everything else will confuse you. Again, all of that said, the first point I made with all of this is, who came up with this, I wonder? Same point, I could easily see race soldiers sitting around. We'll go get some crates and just give it, we'll pay some of these black people, go out and do this, videotape yourself, then we'll go, hey Snoop, make a few, tweet this a few times, or get some other folks, just tell them, make a few tweets. Might even be your job, they could pay people, they could set up bots to do it. Tweet this enough to get it rolling and boop, we'll sit back, social experiment. See how many people we can get to do this, how many shares, all the rest of it. And then we're just promoting black people being ignorant, self-injurious. White genetic annihilation, promote black people being ignorant, self-injurious. No black self-respect. I think some person, when Cal's investor said that they even saw one video where an older black person was climbing up the pyramid and either their child or grandson or a younger person looked like a relative, but a black child kicked the crates and made them fall. I'm just like, wow, like what an image. Like, I mean, black self-respect at ground zero, to see an elder or another black person, a family member, and not even, be thinking, oh, I could hurt them or they could be seriously injured or any of that. Like, oh, I just want to see them be safe. I'm not going to do anything to harm them. And nope, that's not there at all. Ground zero, Dr. Welsing would say, in terms of black self-respect, which is required to maintain this system. But I'm suspicious of anything that white people, they get you to focus your attention on all kinds of goofy things. And for this week at this time with everything that's happening, milk crates? Milk isn't even that popular anymore. They got people, everybody is lactose intolerant and plant-based and all the rest of it. They're getting Oatly and soy milk and rice milk and almond milk and macadamia nut milk and flaxseed milk and on and anything but cow's milk. Like, we're... Anywho, other folks' commentary that they would like to share. Check in again, see if folks are spectating. So many things going on this week. Like, whew, hope folks are paying attention amidst all the stress and strife that we are being stuck with individually. I will say, like, man, I know it's been super stressful for probably everybody in the known universe the last 2 years, basically. Still do as best you can to get out, do some things that are nourishing for yourself. I think caller in Florida had talked about being on the job and seeing a black person be assaulted by the police and all that. And it seemed like it could have been some homoeroticism within the midst of all of it. Seeing those type of things and the other sort of abuses that we are exposed to constantly, it can have a really traumatic effect on your spirit, on your physical body, your emotional body. Just really try as best you can to do things to mitigate that, do things that are going to nourish, eating healthy foods. Talked about all the fresh, yummy fruits down in Florida, getting out. That's going to the beach if you can, even a lane beach. Going out for a hike, going out for a walk, getting some exercise in, hanging out with people that are constructive, where you all don't do any bickering and squabbling about masks or counter racism or anything else. You all can just have fun times, constructive times, like whatever is going to nourish you and help you feel a little bit better, get rid of some of that toxicity and try to get yourself a little bit more balance. That's what we're striving for. Universal man, universal woman, do that. This system can do so much to just really grind us down emotionally, mentally, where we're just fatigued and just end up not wanting to do anything and sitting around watching Netflix and eating bad food and just kind of staying on the couch or staying in bed. And I mean, you could do that for like one day or what have you, but you really want to try and get up and get active. Your body's immune system works better when you are in motion. It's always good to get some fresh air. Summer is winding down, so a lot of us are going to be cooped up inside a lot more as it starts to get cooler. So take advantage the last little bit of summer. Try to get outside, get some sunshine, get some exercise outside, maybe break a sweat a little bit. But all of that does so much just for your health, vitality, thinking, well-being. Try to get outside and enjoy a little bit before it cools down. And just in general, doing things to nourish yourself as this system continues on. We do our best to try to replace it with justice. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll give folks 5 minutes, see if they have any other comments or if they're just spectating anything else that stood out with the many, many things that happened this week. Larry Elder, I will say with Larry Elder, I am closely following that campaign in California. I suspect whites may allow him to become governor. Much left to be decided. I don't believe that the election for or the recall of current Governor Newsom and then if he's going to be replaced, you know, who will take his position. All of that, I think, is supposed to be decided September 14th. So a little less than 3 weeks away, basically 2 weeks away at this point, when all that will be decided. I would not be surprised at all. And it would be whites most to blame on, especially they've had numerous reports over the last couple weeks with, let me see, this is the LA Times. Obviously, they're going to have lots to say about this campaign race, but they had multiple reports. Larry Elder's fans prove he's a face of white supremacy. LA Times, this is yesterday, Friday, super current, last 24 hours, written by Erica D. Smith, black female victim of white supremacy. But I mean, how often, and this was like not front page, but it was pretty high. If you go to LA Times site, like you would see this if you went there yesterday. I'm not going to read the entire report, but she says Larry Elder is not the black face of white supremacy, or at least that's what he keeps telling people. I had to laugh last week when Elder, the radio talk show host who is leading the race to replace Governor Gavin Newsom if he gets recalled, complained to Fox News that I had attacked him in my last column by pointing out that he supports systemically racist policies that would disproportionately harm black people. I anticipated that would happen, Elder told host Sean Hannity. This is why a lot of people don't go into politics, because of the politics of personal destruction. Apparently, you can say anything about an African American and it's fine, a sympathetic Hannity responded a few minutes later. I'm laughing because Hannity has no idea how right he is. Despite Elder's insistence during a recent rally in Woodland Hills that he couldn't possibly be the palatable black face covering for the ugliness of white supremacy, my social media feeds and inbox tell a different story. And then she gives a lot of responses from different white people who called to fuss at her for, you know, critiquing Larry Elder. Cowbell notwithstanding, he allegedly had a white fiance and she said he had a gun and all this. I would not be surprised at all. I've seen so many different videos and things of white people, or at least individuals who look very much like they would be classified as white. Larry Elder, he's our guy. He's going to save California. Larry Elder for governor. Like, wow. I don't even remember images like this with President Obama, where it was just almost like exclusively whites. I don't ever remember that being the case with President Obama. And they wanted to kill him, like in historic numbers. So I'm really like, really? How curious. But he could totally win. I would not be surprised at all. And I would expect all kinds of policies that are very harmful to non-white people, black people. And then it would be the same thing like we had when President Obama was in the White House. Lots of non-white people fussing at this black male who is not in charge at all. Racial showcasing, I think, is more accurate. Sometimes blackface can end up being like a metaphor, different ways of focusing too much attention on a victim of white supremacy. Usual suspects are to blame. And I guess my last California, when they were talking about the different streets in California, they said that Biddy Mason doesn't have a street named after her. She has a park under the parking garage. She has a park under the parking garage in California. Crenshaw, I never knew that Crenshaw was named after an actual white person. I never lived in Southern California, so I'm not obligated to know the whole history of Los Angeles and the state and all that. But Crenshaw, the full name, did I move the tab? Just had it up in front of me. Here we go. Oh, that's James Lowen. The full name for Crenshaw. Let's see. Here we go. Full name. I had the whole tab pulled up and everything. This is also, you can check LA Times. They have a number of different reports here as well. So Crenshaw is named after George Lafayette Crenshaw. Just had Lafayette from Louisiana and totally different context now. George Lafayette Crenshaw, he was a developer in the Southern California area. And so they ended up naming a street after him because he did so much developing and what have you. What did he develop? I'm reading from aninjusticemag.com. Quoting, he built housing tracts with restrictive racial covenants that did not allow blacks, Jewish people, Latinos, and other people to move in. That was the main selling point for these housing tracts, a place where whites can live in a homogenous community without having to access with the associate with the subversive element. Eventually, the restriction covenants led to overcrowding in certain areas in Los Angeles. Blacks and other minorities were pigeonholed, metaphor, into certain areas, denied federal mortgage loans, and were restricted from living in many communities, and many whites continued to add restrictive covenants into their housing contracts. And they go on to talk about how this was carried on forward, but I never even knew. George Lafayette Crenshaw. And the street is still named. I'm sure they're not going to change the name anytime soon. Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
Can I be heard again?
Caller 1159. Yes, sir.
Regarding the white people freaking out in airports and just in general, I see this every single day because in my dwelling complex, I live above this white family, and every single day I hear either the father, grandfather, grandma, or mom cursing at these very small white children or at each other. And it's just like calling children bitch, like bees and using the F words towards each other. And the way they yell at each other, my care mate has described it as sounding very like scary and demonic. And she doesn't like being in the living room because if the door is open and she hears them like yelling at each other, it can be disturbing sometimes. So I do understand where you're coming from with the just absorbing that energy and having ways to combat it and remedies for it. But the airport freakouts are very, very real. Seeing one right now on Twitter, white man is just going crazy. And it's the Yorugu, the energy cannot be used for constructiveness. It can only be used for destruction. I'm in my line.
Much obliged, sir. It's probably, I thought you were good. I don't know if you were at the airport or what have you, but it would not have surprised me. I would have just hoped for your safety, but yeah, it's 24/7. I'll just repeat again. I would not fly for the remainder of the year. If you are one of those folks and you normally do holiday travel for the things that happen in November, December, as we're heading into those months, I would make an alternative right now. If you can drive, do that. If you got to participate in all this, train, do that. Schedule in advance. Might take a little bit longer. Way safer option. I would not fly. If you absolutely have to fly, cancel it. You can catch me next year. I said for the folks where it's like mandatory, like medical emergency, or you're in school on the other side of the so-called country, and so you got to fly back. You got to get from Florida to Washington State, that type of a thing. Morning flight. No connections. You leave as early as possible. That minimizes some of the alcohol right there, because not everybody, but many people don't start their drinking at 6 a.m. So try to get the earliest flight possible. No connects. Minimize, you know, as best you can, the transfer drama. But I mean, if it's not like major emergency type of a thing, got to, no alternatives, no flying for the rest of the year. The terrorism has been way too immense. Any other comments folks need to get in? We'll assume folks are satisfied for the week. We will be back minimum for the book club. Woody Allen, I won't say enjoying, but I am learning. I am learning with Woody Allen, and I'm waiting for when we get to the main part. But that'll be Thursday. Check Black Talk Radio Network social media for updates. We have programs between now and then. Much obliged for folks' participation. Hopefully it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best. Say that again. We need high-functioning brain computers to solve the problem. If you're going to go out and about, they got folks with machetes. It's not a whole lot I can say after that. I mean, do you leave your residence with an axe? Some people do, apparently. if you're out and about, I would be very alert, especially if you have offspring, be very, very alert. If you didn't leave your house prepared to kill and or die, hey, something happens, people are being loud and hostile, exit, get out of there. You have no idea if they're armed, if they have an axe, a machete. You have no idea if they have an entourage that is also armed, machete, ready to kill. If you're driving, addition to being sober, you are buckled, you're not on the cell phone, we need all of our attention, and we're trying to do the most that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling, no gossiping. Safety, thoughts and prayers, not only to Irie, her offspring, folks in the Louisiana area. Safety. We'll be wishing you all the best. It is not an anniversary of Katrina. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.